Broadcasting worldwide on the web, you're listening to 101 WRIF at WRIF.com, a service of Greater Media. Keep it here for more Riff Rock coming right up.
Hello, how are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We had Tom Mabe in the studio. You know this hilarious guy from Revenge of the Telemarketers. Hilarious, man.
I got into Detroit last night, and we're driving around and stuff, you know, just killing time. And I had no idea. I'm so uncultured. I had no idea. Joe Louis, I always thought he was a black man. I saw this big fist, and I was like, damn, such a heck.
Now, what about the telemarketing thing? Is that over?
I hope so. You know, I'm obligated to do it. I'm just telling myself, guys, I got this do not call list. It's not going to happen. Just let me out of this and everything. I'm still getting calls, but I'm just like, you know, these stations, fans, they don't want to hear this stuff anymore.
They don't want to hear it anymore, the telemarketing stuff?
I don't want to hear it. If I do one more interview,
I just got tired of being victimized by telemarketing, you know. I mean,
Drew and Mike in the morning. Yes. Broadcast program. On the Riff. 101-101. WRIF. Riff. Rocks.
Want the inside scoop on your Detroit with us?
Get it from the man who sees it all from the inside.
What a start. Yes, indeed.
101 WRIF brings you Wings analyst Mickey Redmond. Weekday mornings with Drew and Mike. The Mick breaks down all the stuff a true Red Wings fan needs to know.
Here comes Hall. Scores!
The action on the ice, the talk inside the locker room. And what's happening inside the front offices of the Red Wings and the entire NHL.
Really looks like now, guys, St. Louis, as you've heard, fired their coach, Joel Quenneville. And Bobby Francis got fired in Phoenix, so Phoenix is pretty much out of it. It really leaves St. Louis as the only team on the outside looking in. And it looks to me right now, with 5 weeks left in the season, that Nashville, Calgary, Los Angeles, Dallas, and St. Louis, four of those five teams will get in. Only one will miss out. And everybody else is history. They're not going to let something miracle happen here in the last 5 weeks because they're too far behind, including the Anaheim Mighty Ducks and our old buddy Sergei, who have really struggled and had a tough year.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Have they ever.
Hi, this is Mickey Redmond. Get your red on and tune in for all your up-to-the-minute details on your Detroit Red Wings as they gear up to bring Lord Stanley's Cup back home to Hockey Town. Mornings with Drew and Mike on 101 WRIF, The Riff.
101 WRIF.
Riff rocks.
Man, this thing with Richard Clark, the man who wrote the book Against All Enemies, exposing the fact that Bush was just asleep on the job. And I have never seen an attack on an individual like the Republicans are carrying out on Richard Clark, everything from his facts to his character. And it is certainly character assassination. The media pretty much cooperating in it. I mean, giving full voice to all of the calumny being uttered against Richard Clark, this faithful servant. You know, he said the best president of all four that he served under Reagan, Bush Sr., Clinton, and Jr., and he said the best president was Bush, although he voted for Al Gore in 2000. But one of the things that it's always good to look at, I think, is what is obscured by this media blitz. What is out there that if this wasn't there, this big contentious issue, and this is actually not a diversion like gay marriage or you know, some of these other things that they always throw up in our face so we don't think about the real issues that affect us. But and we should be talking about this. And there is this debate over the role of the Bush administration of what did they know and when did they know it is too long in coming. And this commission, which is, seems more like the Warren Commission that, you know, that said that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin of John F. Kennedy, just isn't getting to all the facts at all. Although they're doing a lot more than I ever suspected. Now, we're going to have some guests during the show as well. And not a fancy guest, not an author, anything like that. An average Detroiter who's part of a tour called Show Us the Jobs Tour. It's going to be visiting 8 states and spotlighting the job crisis. And Laura, who's going to be calling in just a little while, is from Detroit. But let's get back to what I was talking about. So what does this flap over Richard Clark's book obscure? What it obscures is Bush's joke. You saw that, didn't you? Bush made this joke about weapons of mass destruction. Now, they have something called the gridiron dinner. And this is where, I don't even understand this. All the politicians and all of the big reporters get together. And what they do, you know, they're buddies. And they don't have a critical distance. I mean, just the very fact that they all meet together seems to me to be absolutely inappropriate. Because who does this benefit? It certainly benefits the politicians. Although, you know, certainly some of these reporters are hard-hitting in their criticism and uncover a lot of dirt. There's a lot, there's less of a tendency to do so if you're buddies. Or at least it gives the appearance of an impropriety. This is why all these people that, like, well, for instance, the case of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. He finds that Bush was being cheated out of the presidency. I mean, he was leading the charge in 2000. And then a couple of weeks later, he and the president have dinner. Yeah. It's like that. So and now Scalia meets with Dick Cheney, the vice president, and Scalia is supposed to make a decision about Cheney's oil energy committee that met secretly. And Cheney won't let any of us know, because really what he's hiding is that Ken Lay and the Enron folks were writing the America's energy bill, which we're lucky they got caught, because we would have wound up just like California. So it was good that Enron crashed when it did. I mean, it would have been good if it had crashed earlier, or would have been in the hands of people that that were honest. And these are the big Bush supporters, right? Now, Bush jokes about the search for weapons of mass destruction. And what was at this dinner, a slide showed Bush in the Oval Office leaning to look under a piece of furniture. Those weapons of mass destruction have got to be here somewhere, he told the audience, drawing applause and laughter. And another slide showed him peering into another part of the office. Nope, no weapons over there, he said, laughing. Maybe you're under here, he said. A third slide was shown. Ah, ha, ha, yuck, yuck, ho, ho, ha, 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 ha. In the meantime, 600 Americans have been killed because of this war that George Bush said solely was about weapons of mass destruction. Almost 4,000 Americans have been critically wounded. Another 6,000 have left Iraq because of medical reasons. Maybe 10,000, 15,000, we don't bother to count the Iraqis who were liberating, are dead as well. And this is a big joke. So this is what's being disguised. Also, if you think about it, what has the Bush administration done since it's been in office? What are its accomplishments? We know all the negative stuff. We know about the assault on the environment, the lost jobs, being driven into a debtor status, the fact that all of our fate, economic fate, jobs, what have you, seem so much more insecure. We know all the negative stuff. What's the one positive thing that people attribute to the Bush administration? That he is tough on terror. That he's a strong president and leader. That he's protecting us. He's Big Brother and Big Daddy. Without him, might have some weak Democrat in there. And you know, they waffle on defense. I mean, how do these images ever get started? I don't know. But the attack on Richard Clark, who says that the Bush administration was asleep at the wheel. Remember George Bush in August of 2001? He went off on a month's vacation. Nothing happening here. Why should we bother to, why should we bother to do anything? Well, the book by Richard Clark, Against All Enemies, as I said, has been subject. The book and the author have been subject to an attack like I have never seen before. It was like they were nice. The Republicans were nice to Bill Clinton compared to what they're doing to Richard Clark. And they're doing that because if you pull this, actually my analogy is wrong. I was saying if you pull out this one brick, the whole structure is going to collapse. That's the whole structure of the Bush administration, of the Bush regime. He's strong on terrorism. Well, we know now from any number of sources, and actually I didn't need Richard Clark to tell me that they ignored all the warning signs, that an attack on the United States was imminent. Now, here's what Bush said. Well, for one thing, listen to this poll. The headline's absolutely ridiculous. Clark doubted This is according to a poll. Bush support ebbs. No, wait, that doesn't make a bit of sense. Clark is doubted, according to this headline. Two-thirds of Americans say the testimony of Richard Clark, the former terrorism advisor who had been critical of the Bush administration, hasn't affected their view of the president. Well, to a large extent, that's true. It didn't affect my view at all. So they would say, did Richard Clark affect your view at all? And I would say, no. This just confirms what I believed all along. Now, the public views supporting Bush's handling of terrorism has dropped from 65% to 57% in the last month, according to the New York Times poll. And let me see. I thought there was something else here. 17% said Clark's testimony made them view Bush less favorably. All right. Also, Kerry. Kerry and Bush in a dead heat for the presidency. Now, here's what Bush said. This was at a you know, I'm sure, some friendly little venue that he always talks in front of. This was in Nashua, New Hampshire, to Republicans. He said, had I known that the enemy was going to use airplanes to strike America to attack us, I would have used every resource, every asset, every power of this government to protect the American people. Had I known the enemy was going to use airplanes to strike America to attack us, I would have used every resource, every asset, every power of the government to protect the American people. Well, hello, I suppose that's true. If someone would have said, hey, George, they're coming on September 11th, and they're going to hijack airplanes, and they're going to get onto the airplanes with one-way tickets, paying cash, and they're going to all take off from Boston, and he would have known that. I mean, all but a few of us would agree he probably would have done something to stop it. But that's not the issue. The issue is, was there any prior warning? The whole administration, since it's lied all along, is now lying again about this. I mean, everywhere you look. Here's this, a former FBI wiretap translator with top secret security clearance who's been called very credible by Senator Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa, told Salon.com she recently testified to the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States that the FBI had detailed information prior to September 11th that a terrorist attack involving airplanes was being plotted. We should have had orange or red type alert in June or July of 2001. There was that much information available. So they said they had no warning whatsoever. In fact, the warnings go back as early as 1999. A 1999 report prepared by the Library of Congress for the National Intelligence Council, quote, warned that Osama bin Laden's terrorists could hijack an airliner and fly it into government buildings like the Pentagon. The Bushies, Bush Co., says they had no idea. July 2001, the LA Times reported that U.S. and Italian officials were warned in July 2001 that Islamic terrorists might attempt to kill President Bush and other leaders by crashing an airliner into the Genoa summit of industrialized nations. So worried was Bush that they had anti-aircraft guns set up around the meeting place, and Bush slept out on a ship. John Ashcroft stopped flying commercial because of threat assessment. Attorney General John Ashcroft stopped flying commercial airlines in July of 2001, traveling exclusively by leased jet aircraft instead of commercial airlines because of what the Justice Department called a threat assessment. And never was increased airport security ever instituted. August 2001, Bush is on vacation. He's joking how he's going to work 24/7. 24 days a month, 7 months a year. Another big joke, like how he jokes about weapons of mass destruction in the face of the destruction of thousands of human beings. Now, let's see here. This was ABC News reported. The Bush administration, quote, officials acknowledged that U.S. intelligence officials informed President Bush weeks before the September 11th attack that bin Laden's terrorist network might try to hijack American planes. On August 6, 2001, the president personally, quote, received a one-and-one-half page briefing advising him that Osama bin Laden was capable of a major strike against the U.S. and that the plot could include the hijacking of an American plane. And in September 2001, Pentagon officials changed flights on September 11th because of security. A group of top Pentagon officials suddenly canceled travel plans for that morning, apparently because of security concerns. Newsweek also reported that as many as 10 to 12 warnings were issued before September 11th, and more than two of the warnings specifically mentioned the possibility of headlines. These people are a pack of liars. They are complicit in September 11th because of misfeasance. Some of you think it's malfeasance. Malfeasance means you did an evil deed. Misfeasance means that you screwed up. You know, whatever you think of Richard Clark and this whole thing, he's doing it for the money. Hey, I'll tell you, if Richard Clark would have written this book, if Richard Clark would have written his book Against All Enemies and said, oh, President Bush is just the most wonderful human being and he's our leader in the war against terrorism, none of these Bushies would have been out there saying he's doing it for the money and for the publicity. And they wouldn't have trotted out these Republican the September 11th families and what have you to impugn Clark's character. You know where Clark's character really came up to me? He apologized to representatives of the families of September 11th victims. He apologized for his failure as the Bush administration terrorist advisor because the government was not vigilant enough. You know, when things happen on your watch, you're responsible. You know the old Harry Truman thing, the buck stops here? The buck doesn't stop anywhere. It just gets passed all down the line in the Bush administration. Even if there was not that kind of blatant ignoring of all the warnings that something was going to happen, why didn't Bush say our government failed? Because it did. It failed to heed the warning signs, and thousands of people died. And as a result of that, thousands and thousands of people more have died and are dying every day. Civilians are dying every day in Afghanistan and in Iraq, because of the failures of the Bush administration. And the only person in the Bush administration, which was Richard Clark, that they had the humanity to say, we're sorry. Oh, well, he put it in the first person. I'm sorry. Well, all right. As I said, we were going to talk some about jobs tonight as well. And a Detroiter is traveling with the Show Us the Jobs tour. And here's what's happening. 51 Americans, one from every state in the District of Columbia, are part of a bus tour through eight states and 18 cities to showcase the devastating impact that the lack of good jobs has on Americans and their families and our communities. And let's say hello to Laura. Laura's from Detroit. Laura, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, tell us more about this. What this has been organized by the AFL-CIO?
Yes, in conjunction. The AFL-CIO is who is sponsoring this program, but we are on a bus tour with 51 riders from all over the country that not only union reps, but just your average American worker who at the moment is either unemployed, underemployed, or simply just cannot find a job.
What category are you in, Laura?
Currently, I'm underemployed. I'm a law graduate with a law degree from Brooklyn Law School this last summer who is working for $7 an hour at a deli down in Eastern Market.
I probably know the deli.
Yeah, Rivertown Deli, actually.
No, I don't. Okay, good. I was hoping my friend Bob paid better wages than that. I think he does. Anyways, but you live in Detroit? You went to school in Brooklyn, but you're a Detroiter?
I'm Michigan native, Detroit native, and now currently live Gratiot and Russell, so yes.
Yeah. Oh, so you live near the Eastern Market or in it?
Yeah, it's a walk to work.
Yeah, well, that's good, I guess.
Yeah, save on some gas money.
And tell us about the tour, a little more of who's on it and what kind of people and what kind of reaction are you getting?
We're getting a phenomenal reaction, I have to say. But it's a large gamut of human beings. I mean, we have a 19-year-old is our youngest rider, Ian, from New Hampshire. And our oldest rider is a 73-year-old retired priest from Oklahoma. Large range of professions. We have union workers, iron workers, people from the IT who have been affected by offshoring. We have auto workers, lawyers, people who have been working for the airlines. Name it, we've got it.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the reaction's been phenomenal, who has been the people reacting?
Basically communities. This afternoon we are in a community in Michigan, Greenville, which is over near the Grand Rapids area, that has been affected by, in 2005, Electrolux, which makes refrigeration and a lot of vacuum parts, is going to be moving to Mexico. It's a community of about 4,500, and they're losing 2,700 jobs. So we were there today, and we had a crowd of about 1,000 just to hear what we had to say and get the message out.
Well, and are you putting this at the feet of the Bush administration or just sort of the vagaries of the market?
I would say vagaries of the market primarily, simply because we don't just have Democrats on the bus. We just don't have, you know, Bush bashers on the bus. We have Republicans. We have independents. We have Democrats, all just frustrated with politicians not making the job crisis their number one priority.
Yeah, I'll tell you that most of the time we're spent here talking about Iraq, talking about everything other than what keeps coming up as the number one priority of Americans, and that's the economy and job security.
Exactly. You know, you can talk about Iraq, you can talk about gay marriage, you can talk about peripheral issues, but and I hate to say that that's a peripheral issue, but the thing is that if Americans aren't working and Americans aren't consuming, where is that going to take us?
Yeah. Well, is your show is the jobs tour, your bus tour. Is there specific solutions, or is it just demonstrating the problem?
I think it's more of a demonstration of the problem. I think, at least for myself, before coming on the tour, was simply frustrated with my own situation, thinking I was alone out there. But meeting people from 50 states, District of Columbia, and knowing that it's happening in their communities, smaller communities, bigger cities, regardless where you're from, that it's happening on a nationwide basis. It's a frightening but eye-opening experience.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. If people want to look this up, I'm going to put this. I should have done this already. My apologies.
No problem.
Well, I was going to say I was going to put your website on my website, showusthejobs.com. And I know there's a lot of people here listening to the broadcast that are unemployed. What are the three categories? Unemployed, underemployed,
and simply just looking.
Yeah.
One of our biggest problems, I think, is that the unemployment rate is based just simply on who is filing for unemployment, but people like myself can't file. So the true unemployment rate, I don't think, really is reflecting the majority of Americans.
Well, I hope this does become the number one issue, because you're right. I have this here somewhere, that how the Bush administration is trying to use every other issue under the sun to, here it is. Republicans pressing cultural issues, so that they're trying to orient everything around, the federal crime to injure or kill a fetus in the during an attack, gay marriage, and again, these are important issues. But
that's not your primary goal. That's not what America's built on. Now, those are issues you can decide and discuss after people are working. People can't discuss those issues if you can't put food on the table.
Well, thank you so much, Laura, for joining us, and good luck on the rest of your tour. How many more cities does your bus have as on their itinerary?
We're midway through, so hitting 18 cities. We've got about 9 left, and culminating here in D.C. at the end of the trip, and hopefully going to a Bush financial campaign rally, maybe making a presence there.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Laura from Detroit on the bus. Show us the jobs tour. Showusthejobs.com. It'll be on my website, peterwerbe.com, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E.com. Bush said, March 11th, over 1 million jobs were lost because of the September 11th attack. Yeah, no responsibility for anything. The Bureau of National Affairs says the White House officials were unable to point to any specific information that supports a direct link between massive job losses and the attacks. It kind of sounds good. Hey, we got attacked, so we lost all these jobs. But there ain't a bit there to support Bush's contention. It's another lie. All right, let's go to our phones. I'm Peter Werbe. This is the Night Call Show, and our number is 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. It's Funky. How you doing?
Hi.
Just wanted to make a point on Iraq. You brought up this website before. It's Snopes.com, S-N-O-P-E-S.
Yeah.
And there's basically they substantiate the credibility of whether they be rumors or whatnot,
right,
and determine if they're false, undetermined, or true.
Right.
And one of the links on their website deals with a bunch of Russian MiGs that were recently found in the Iraqi desert. It was essentially an airport of these Russian MiGs that were buried in the sand. And my point, and I guess I'd ask for your comment on it, would be we have to go back to 91 when the whole origination of this took place with an unprovoked invasion of another country, and a treaty was made for inspections,
which
the country didn't comply with. Now,
it did. Turned out they did comply with it, that there were no significant weapons, in fact, virtually none after 1994. If you have Bush joking about the fact that he can't find any weapons of mass destruction, I mean, don't you think that means that there ain't any?
Well, that's kind of my point. When it's taken almost a year to find, several Russian MiGs buried in the sand where...
Well, wait a minute. Did they find them or not?
Yeah, it's documented on Snopes.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I hadn't heard anything about it. But we're talking about, weapons in the... And I don't know, a MiG is not a weapon of mass destruction. It's a fighter plane. It may have been forbidden under what Iraq was allowed to have. But that wasn't the contention. Remember, it was immediate, imminent, a direct threat. Our country was going to be hit with chemical weapons. It was all a big lie. All right, thank you. One of the things here, bringing freedom to Iraq, right? The U.S.-led coalition on Sunday shut down a weekly newspaper run by followers of a Shiite Muslim cleric, saying its articles were increasing the threat of violence against occupation forces. So, freedom of the press ended by men with bayonets. Ain't that sweet? All right, continuing onward, 313-298-WRIF. Oh, if you want to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Let's see here. George from Taylor writes, I watched C-SPAN 2 book review today, and there was an author of a book about George W. Bush, and he quoted Abraham Lincoln's phrase referring to George W. Bush. He respected truth so much, he used it very sparingly. I like that. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello, this is Greg from Hazel Park.
Hi, Greg.
Actually, I had a comment about the candidacy for president right now. I think after 9/11, any president that gets in office is going to be very vigilant on terrorism now. They're going to be paying attention to the warnings that come from FBI, CIA, wherever.
Sure.
I think what's more important right now, especially with the guess that you had, is the job market. We need to get a president in that's not going to negotiate away our jobs. For instance, Bush is going to be negotiating, I believe it's with Thailand or Taiwan, one of the two, about a trade agreement where they wouldn't have to pay tariffs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if that happens, your truck market's going to be flooded with all these cheap trucks that compete with our brands, Mitsubishi or the Daimler Chrysler, Ford, GM, you're going to turn Detroit into a ghost town.
Well, it's about a half a ghost town now. I mean, the idea that we could revitalize it seems more and more dubious every day. So that's really a problem. But yeah, we got to keep our eyes on the economy, because this is where we're getting fleeced. Besides all these jobs fleeing, the middle class and the working class is just being ripped off. We're a debtor nation again. We're going to be spending a lot of our tax dollars that isn't going to pay Bush's friends in the military and Bush's friends in the reconstruction industries is going to go for debt service. And the younger you are, the more you're going to be paying. So you're going to work to pay off the debt that George W. Bush has incurred for this country when just a mere 3 years ago, this we had a surplus. All right, thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate your call. Let's do this. Let's take a break. And Hash Bash, that's where people challenge and rally for drug law reform in Ann Arbor. And I'm multitasking, as they call it now, and I'm no good at it. All right, let me focus. That the Hash Bash occurs the first Saturday in April every year, calling for drug policy reform. We'll play our song, Hash Bash, when we come back on Night Call.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
I guess it's the way my parents raised me. I've always believed in myself.
But when it came to getting a college degree, there always seemed to be something getting in the way. Until I discovered University of Phoenix. They understand what it means to be a working adult.
I can enroll in one course at a time and attend evening classes at a campus just a few miles away. With instructors who work in the fields they teach,
I can even apply what I've learned the next day on the job. And it was actually easier than I expected to get the ball rolling.
I simply made an appointment with an enrollment counselor. Instead of starting classes next year, I'm starting next month.
Hey, I still believe in myself. And now I found a university that believes in me, too.
Busy professionals can earn their bachelor's or master's degree without interrupting their lives at the University of Phoenix Metro Detroit campuses. Offering state-of-the-industry programs that qualify for employer reimbursement. Financing options are available. Call 1-800-MY-SUCCESS to learn more. That's 1-800-MY-SUCCESS. You can do this.
Looking for the right mix of on-road handling and off-road capability? Look no further than the versatile Jeep Liberty. From the city to the country, Liberty comes well-equipped with standard features like air, power windows and locks, remote keyless entry, and now one extra comfort. A great deal. Now, qualified returning Daimler Chrysler employee lessees can lease a Liberty for just $189 a month for 39 months with $2,134 due at signing. Tax, title, and license extra. Plus, you'll also get great protection, including the security of our 7-year or 70,000-mile powertrain limited warranty. So get into this great $189 a month lease on Jeep Liberty by getting to your Chrysler and Jeep superstores today. Call 1-888-299-JEEP for lease example details. Offer may require dealer participation. Residency restrictions apply. Take retail delivery by April 30th. See dealer for a copy of limited warranty. Transferable to a second owner with a fee. A deductible applies. Jeep is a registered trademark of Daimler Chrysler.
Mickey Redmond here for Tuffy Auto Service Centers. I'm sure you're familiar with some of the expressions I've used over the years, like chin music, bingo bango, and Katie bar the door. Well, here's another one for you. For every season, there's a reason to take your car to Tuffy. And now spring is here, that time of year when hockey players try to heal the bumps and bruises of a long season and get ready for the playoffs ahead. Likewise, it's time to take your car to Tuffy and get it ready for warm weather driving. Get an oil change, filter, and lube at Tuffy. And while you're there, have them check your brakes and exhaust system for wear.
Need brakes? That's a Tuffy. Visit Tuffy now during their big brake sale and get 50% off brake pads and shoes. You heard right. A big 50% off the list price of brake pads and shoes for most cars and light trucks, labor not included. And these aren't just any brakes. They're Tuffy brakes. It'll be a long time before you find brakes this good for 50% off. So stop, if you can, at Tuffy today.
Take it from the Mick. You can trust the gang at Tuffy for all your car needs this spring. Because at Tuffy, we fix cars.
Has your day sounded something like this? Perhaps you need to change your tune. May I suggest a Captain Morgan's Parrot Bay Breeze, made in sweet harmony with pineapple and cranberry. Ah, music to the senses. Captain Morgan's Parrot Bay Coconut Flavored Rum. The rum capital of the world is closer than you think. It's in your glass whenever you pour a Puerto Rican rum. Only the finest rums come from Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rican rum with natural coconut flavor. 21 to 24% alcohol by volume. Captain Morgan Rum Company. Drink responsibly. Captain's orders.
Spark your night with a tropical taste of Captain Morgan's Parrot Bay Coconut Flavored Rum. Enjoy a bay breeze made with pineapple and cranberry. Parrot Bay and cola or a Parrot Bay and cranberry. Mix them all with good friends and good times.
David Hall here with Trudy Daniels, the honorary mortgage expert. Trudy, don't know if you heard, Greenspan just reported fixed rate mortgages are potentially way too expensive. Folks need to look at adjustables. Did you hear?
I know. He says that. And a recent Census Bureau study seems to agree. Most Americans live in their homes on average 5 to 7 years. So why pay thousands of additional dollars in interest for long-term money they'd never use?
Great point.
I don't think I would have come up with it had you not prompted me, but...
A Rock Financial mortgage expert can really make the difference with a little expert advice, as you well know.
So they can show me the difference between an adjustable and a fixed rate on paper, and I'll know?
You bet. Folks will be amazed at the money you can save in interest over the life of their loan by matching your mortgage to your lifestyle.
Oh, are we talking big dollars here?
Big.
Really big.
Big.
Call Rock Financial, 800-333-ROCK. Or go to rockfinancial.com. They are Michigan's largest mortgage company, ready to help you 24 hours a day.
24 hours a day.
That's right, 800-333-ROCK. Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company, equal housing lender.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can restore your energy, youthful sex drive, and staying power. Testosterone keeps a man energetic and sexually confident. You can feel that way no matter what your age. Testostazine can help.
Call now for your risk-free, confidential trial of testosterone. Call 1-800-807-8108. 1-800-807-8108. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. Call 1-800-807-8108. Results will vary.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
All right, hey, it's Hash Bash time.
And there really is better things to do than to be hanging around. We've got a date in a town named Michigan, and we're sending a protest wish again to all of those who still have ears, let them hear. Cause we're going to the hash, and I'm a hash, and I'm a hash bash. We're gonna see some folks, and man, we'll have some fun. Now the laws that they're making do more harm than the ones we're breaking. And we'll see you there, don't be late. I ain't talking about crack, and it ain't about smack. Hemp don't fit with dangerous stuff like that. The soft drugs aren't the same, so let's call them by their name. We gotta make some changes, so let's start with hemp. Cause we're going to the hash, and over hash, and over hash bash. We gotta see some folks out, man, we'll have some fun. Now the laws that they're making do more harm than the ones we're breaking. And I'll see you on the diag at U of M.
Yeah, that's next Saturday. Let's go back to our phones. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. By the way, that was the band Burning Incense and the album Get Me High from 1995. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. This is Marvin of the Party Party.
Marvin, and he is not stuttering, folks. That is his name. Marvin Squared. Not Square, but Squared. Hi.
Hi, Peter.
What a coincidence.
Yeah, this weekend. It's the 33rd annual Ann Arbor Hash Bash.
Yeah. Wow, you're going to be there.
I am.
And the crowds have varied. I mean, sometimes I remember in the past, we haven't talked on the air maybe in a couple of years, but you used to tell me there was like 30,000 people there, Marvin. I always doubted your figures.
The one year you showed up, how many people were there?
Thousands.
Thousands, all right.
Yeah. So
if the weather's nice, and it looks like it will be, there will be 30,000.
And I remember I was up there with Drew and Mike and Trudy from the WRF Morning Show. We had T-shirts made up. I was just playing handball wearing one of them.
Can we do that again? Can we get them out again?
I don't know. Everybody's running scared with the FCC. Bush's buddies trying to tighten the screws on broadcasters.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, they decide these things way in advance. I think I talked them into it, and they probably thought it was a bad idea. Why did we listen to Werby? That's probably that. But they had a good time.
I think they did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it's noon on the Michigan Diag, which is at State and what?
It's right in the middle of the university area. Everybody, if you get to Ann Arbor, you just ask for the Diag. Everybody knows how to get there.
All right, let me tell people that I tell them every time. If you go, the people say, oh, wow, man, if I get busted, it'll just be a $5 fine. If you're on University of Michigan property, where the rally is being held, it is state property, and you are possibly subject to, for one thing, if you're caught, you'd be immediately arrested, and you are subject to, I believe, a possible year in prison and $5,000 fine.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, so go there to exercise your rights, but be careful, and the cops look like hippies, the ones that will arrest you.
It's more than a five. Did you say $5 fine? I think it's been increased inflation and all. I'm not sure what.
Yeah, it is. But if you're on Ann Arbor streets, they're a little more sensible than the state of Michigan. Well, we say legalize it, man. Right.
Well, let me tell who's going to be there this time. John Sinclair is going to be speaking. Our old friend John Sinclair. But and in addition, rather, Jack Herer is going to be there. Jack Herer is, of course, the author of the book The Emperor Wears No Clothes,
which is. Yeah, I'm sorry. I talked right over. The Emperor Wears No Clothes, Jack Herer, H-E-R-E-R, a very, very important book to read and understand why there is hemp prohibition.
He's been on your show before a few years ago.
He has.
People in the know that Jack had a stroke a few years ago, but he's fully recovered, and it'll be great to see him. It'll be his first appearance in Ann Arbor since he had his stroke.
Yeah. And John Sinclair is wonderful. He's back from Amsterdam, and he spoke at, I was up in Ann Arbor for the anti-war march on March 20th, and John Sinclair spoke and was eloquent and to the point, as always.
And then following the bash, there's going to be a music festival on Monroe Street, which is only a short walk from the Diag. And
right.
Sinclair will be performing there again, and there'll be bands, and there'll probably be some speakers. And then at 4:20, there's going to be the State Normal Conference, National Organization for Reform of Marijuana Laws. The state conference is going to be in the Michigan League, and following the conference, we're going to have a Know Your Rights video and panel discussion with lawyers and police officers.
Well, that sounds great. Well, absolutely. You know, I wasn't going to show up, but with John Sinclair and Jack Herer there, I wouldn't miss it.
Yeah, I also want to, if I may, put in a plug for the Detroit Medical Marijuana Initiative, which is going to be on the ballot in August, the August election primary in the city of Detroit, which is basically going to make medical marijuana the least kind of offense that the police would bother anybody about. And but it requires a vote of the people, so it's important that people who live in Detroit come out in August to vote on the Detroit Medical Marijuana Initiative.
Marvin, thanks as usual. I'll see you in Ann Arbor.
May I do one more thing?
No, because I know what it is.
No, you don't. Partyparty.com.
Okay.
P-A-R-T-I-E, party.com.
All right, thank you.
So people can get in touch with me.
All right, hey, you can put it on my website. Marvin, write me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. as well as any other listener with a website, and I'll put it on my listeners page. You can go to the top of peterwerby.com, and you'll see it. Thanks. I'll see you on the Diag at the University of Michigan next Saturday. Hi, it's WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Apparently, Marx had it wrong. History seems to be repeating itself first as tragedy and then again as tragedy.
Yeah, I think so. What are you referring to, though?
Bush in the White House, a war in Iraq,
yeah.
Joblessness. Bush in the White House, a war in Iraq, joblessness.
Yeah.
It's the economy, stupid.
Right. That's what people have to focus on, I think.
That we do, because the economy sucks. There are no jobs. Those of us that have jobs are at the mercy of our employers, even if we do have unions. You know?
I do, indeed. And it's precarious. What happens when you have all these layoffs, for instance? The same level of production occurs. So what they say then is productivity is up. But it's classically, no one uses this phrase anymore, not even the union movement that I know of. It's a classic speed up. The same amount of work is done by fewer employees. And so the great god of efficiency takes precedence over people working in a situation where there's human and physical and emotional comfort. But who the hell cares about that when we're after maximum profit for the stockholders, right?
That's right. That's what matters, the stockholders and the these high-priced executive bonuses.
I just saw in the New York Times little place I've got my eyes on when I move out of my little cottage in the suburbs, a $75 million mansion. Oh, I know, I'm only kidding. Actually,
$75 million?
Yeah, I'm only kidding. There's another one for $50 million. I'm going for that one. All right, thanks a lot.
Adios.
Appreciate your call. This is important. Going back to the Richard Clark book, Against All Enemies, Ron listening in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and you can... you can listen on WRIF.com, anywhere in the world. Peter, have you ever heard Richard Clark mention former FBI Assistant Director John O'Neill at all? Now, the FBI is very important in this. He was the guy who was totally obsessed with nailing Osama bin Laden, as it appears Clark was as well, and resigned from the Bush administration because he, too, couldn't get this bunch of dumbasses to pay attention to the threat being raised by Al-Qaeda. The sad thing about O'Neill is that after getting out of government employ, he took up the job of security chief at, of all places, the World Trade Center, where he perished on September 11th, 2 weeks after being hired as security chief. And there was another, I'm looking for this. We'll go on to our next caller. Thank you, Rick Fox. Rick Fox, by the way, is our producer and phone screener tonight. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. How's it going?
Going well, thanks.
Hi. I'm actually not too familiar with your show. I just tuned in on my way home from work and was interested in the topic when you were speaking with the young woman. And pardon me, I've forgiven her name.
Laura.
It was on the tour, the jobs tour.
Yeah, Laura.
Yeah, I not so much issue with her, and I should say as a precursor before I start that I sympathize with any American who's been laid off from their job or is looking for employment and can't find it, because I've been in that situation and I understand how frustrating it is. But I do have some issue with you. I feel that, I've only been listening for a brief time, but I feel that you're sort of pushing an agenda and you weren't asking the appropriate questions I thought of her that would really bolster her argument and yours after that.
I can always learn. What should I have asked her?
Well, for one, she said that she'd had a law degree and then she was working in a deli for $7 an hour, and I can understand that, but you didn't ask her to tie that back in how Bush would have cost her that job, or you didn't ask her where she was currently employed, how she applied her particular degree, and how she had lost her job due to this president or this economy.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was important to the subject matter, and I was interested in what she had to say, but I just felt that that was lacking. And I felt personally that that was lacking because you didn't care that what the answer to those questions were, but that you were just going to use what she said to bolster your argument, which is I take as a very anti-Bush. Now, I'm an independent thinker, and I try to be an independent voter, but I like to know the other side. I like to know the flip side. Also, she said that she didn't qualify for unemployment. Well, if she's employed, then, yeah, she doesn't qualify for unemployment. I would have liked to have seen you touch on that
a little bit
as well.
I didn't want to keep her on for 20 minutes. I mean, at 1 a.m., I play some interviews that go 25 minutes, and then they're fairly extensive. And also, I would say that her appearance was provocative in that it made you question, it made you call, it made you consider this, it made you critical. So, I mean... all of that, even if it was a failing on my part, comes around and, as far as I'm concerned,
purpose
successful.
Served completely, yes, as far as your program goes. But I would just like to see you be a little more in depth. And the same goes, and your last caller and a few callers before that, talking about the 9/11 and where the blood lies. And I hear a lot of Bush bashing on that, but yet I don't hear any blame delegated to Clinton or even Bush 41 before that, when I think there was an all-out failure probably for the last three administrations. But and when you take into consideration that Bush was in office for 7 months before 9/11, where Bill Clinton dealt with Osama bin Laden for 8 years and failed to get to the root of the problem. And
well, if you want to put it off on Clinton of having had years to deal with it, that's one thing, although they appeared to be highly focused on terrorism and al-Qaeda. The charges by Richard Clark and by Paul O'Neill, the Secretary of Treasury, who resigned, and another critic, another person who was subject to great character assassination, was that they didn't have the focus, that they were told by Sandy Berger, they were told by Madeleine Albright that this was a problem. Here, let me just quickly read something. It's about a paragraph or so.
Okay.
This is from the people that I think very highly of, Center for American Progress. I think it's tied in with the Democratic Party, so you can judge that for what you will. And it's the website is centerforamericanprogress.org. Condoleezza Rice claimed that the president increased counterterrorism funding several-fold before September 11th. David Sirota, writing this, says the statement is wholly dishonest and inaccurate. In reality, the Bush administration was preparing a fiscal year 2003 budget, the first budget fully authored by the new administration that proposed serious cuts to key counterterrorism programs. In the New York Times, they said the Bush White House did not endorse FBI requests for $58 million for 149 new counterterrorism field agents, 200 intelligence analysts, and 54 additional translators, and proposed a $65 million cut for the program that gives state and local counterterrorism grants. So they actually ignored all the warnings of the Clinton administration. Let's say they were totally inept. I'm not a Democrat. I didn't think a whole lot of Clinton and Gore. I mean, by comparison, they seem like Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln. But at the time, I was always quite critical of them as well. This 54 additional translators was exceptionally important. And that's why the FBI wanted them. They had this backlog of stuff they could not translate. And Bush said, we don't need this. In fact, Osama bin Laden is even mentioned in Ashcroft's top seven priorities. They were asleep at the wheel.
No, and listen, I don't doubt their negligence on it at all. But my greater point is that the way you frame the argument, you slowly let the blood soak on Bush's hands when I think that I think Clinton had his fair share of responsibility towards 9/11, as did partially, from my readings, Bush 41.
Well, let's say that he did, but who was President of the United States in charge of all this between January 20th of 2001 and September 11th? Well, we both know the answer to that.
I don't dispute that at all, but I think that to frame it up as though al-Qaeda was only a threat or only as imminent a threat as they proved to be on 9/11 was from January 20th, 2001 until September 11, 2001 is insulting to me and I think probably to some of your other viewers to say that they weren't a gathering threat. And I know I'm using a lot of British terminology. but and that's probably not playing well with you. But to say that they weren't a threat and they weren't a growing threat or that they weren't, that we didn't have other warnings or that there weren't other attempts that were foiled or caught or maybe that just weren't unsuccessful the previous 12 years, I think is a bit ridiculous. And I would just, as a listener, and like I said, I'm, first time listener, not first time, but really the first time that you really caught my eye or caught my ear, I would like to see you present both sides of the argument because it sounds like you have a bit of an agenda to push.
Well, wait a minute. Saying one has an agenda has this real negative quality to it. I have very, 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 very strong partisan views. I despise Bush, all the people in his administration. I think they're a pack of liars. I think they're sending this country to hell in a handbasket. So, give the other side. 99.9% of every talk show in America is right-wing, neoconservative. All these, they field these drug addicts and ex-felons and right-wing wackos. And so then when somebody, to a little bit to the left of Mussolini says, "Gee, I don't like George W. Bush," We have an agenda. Well, you know, Rush Limbaugh has an agenda. I know his main agenda is stay out of jail, like he advocated other druggies, go to jail. But, but that's...
Sides, left and right, there are people that throw bombs from both sides. I would like just an honest, fair opinion, and you can give the disclaimer that I understand that you despise Bush, but just give an honest, objective argument for both sides, and then let me decide.
Okay, let's leave it at that.
That's the basis of your program, but...
No, but I appreciate your comments.
And if I could get in one more quick thing, the last caller about the FCC, or the last comment that was made about the FCC, you said Bush is fighting the FCC, constantly trying to take away freedoms. I don't have a problem with people pushing the envelope on one side, but I also don't have a problem with people trying to rein them in on the other. I think that makes for a pretty good in-between where we can all live with. So.
Thank you for joining us.
All right, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Here's something about Clear Channel. They own full disclosure. I work for a media corporation called Greater Media, Inc. It's headquartered in Boston. They own three stations in the Detroit market, including WRIF. And it owns a massive 16 radio stations. Clear Channel owns almost 1,300. Clear Channel rejected Howard Stern's claims that he was canned. Remember, they fired him from the Clear Channel stations for slamming Bush, and says its radio network does not have a political agenda. And we're talking about political agenda with our last caller. Now, there's more information coming out. New political contribution data tells a different story about Clear Channel executives. They have given $42,000 to Bush so far. This is just the executives out of their own pocket. They're going to give a lot more versus $1,700 to likely Democratic nominee John Kerry. What's more, the executives in Clear Channel's Political Action Committee gave 77% of their $334,000 in federal contributions to the Republicans. That's a bigger share than any other entertainment company, says the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics. So they overwhelmingly, almost giving 80% of the money to Republicans, and it's larger than any other entertainment company. For instance, Viacom, that owns that syndicates Stern Show, gave just 30% of their $500,000 to Republican candidates. So it's pretty clear. It's Republican censorship.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the Riff Cyber Crew. It's your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the Riff on-air giveaways. Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air. Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, this sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the Riff Cyber Crew today. Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream. It's a miracle.
It's great for women. Too. To WRIF.com. More Riff Rock is coming right up.
Depression is a disabling condition that will affect one in five people sometime during their life. There are many warning signs of depression that often go unnoticed. Sleeping and eating patterns may change. A simple activity may seem impossible. Decision-making becomes difficult. Depression leaves you feeling hopeless and worthless. You feel tired and lack motivation to get out and do the things you used to enjoy. Life becomes discouraging and nothing feels satisfying. And this may leave you feeling guilty. It's important to understand that depression is a medical condition, not a personality flaw or weakness. Dr. Robert Bielski and the Institute for Health Studies are conducting research on an investigational medication for depression. If you are selected to participate, all research-related care and study medication is provided at no cost by our team of doctors, nurses, and research staff. Call the Institute for Health Studies toll-free at 1-877-908-CARE. That's 1-877-908-CARE.
Imagine not being afraid to go to the dentist. Imagine being able to accomplish all your dental care in as little as one appointment. This is what sedation dentistry at Dr. Katz in Livonia can do for you. You'll be able to smile with confidence and be proud of your appearance. If you've been putting off years of dental work, sedation dentistry will change your life. Over 35 million Americans have some level of anxiety when it comes to going to the dentist. But for many, it's more than being afraid. At Dr. Katz in Livonia, they understand that your fears may have kept you from a dentist, but there's no need to feel embarrassed. at Dr. Katz in Livonia, they're not here to judge you. They're here to help you and encourage you so that you can have the confidence a beautiful smile can bring. The experienced clinical team members at Dr. Katz in Livonia will make certain that you're relaxed and completely comfortable as they monitor you very closely while you're sedated. Many patients feel no discomfort whatsoever during and after treatment. It may be as simple as taking a pill. Let Dr. Katz help you to enjoy your visits to the dentist with Sedation Dentistry. Wake up to a beautiful smile at Dr. Katz in Livonia. Call today for your free consultation at 734-464-2000. That's 734-464-2000.
You're logged on at WRIF.com. We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
With Valentine's Day, it was time to hit the old doghouse stories.
My wife and I don't work the same hours, so our sex life really sucks in the first place.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm doing a lonely pony in front of a computer.
Oh, no. And she caught you.
No. The worst.
Her mom caught you.
Her mom comes to the front door.
Oh.
I look over my shoulder. There's her mom sticking her head in. I clean myself up real quick, and me and my wife finally get something going. She goes, "Well, don't you want to set it up for my mother?"
Have you spoken to her mother since then?
Unfortunately, yeah, but I didn't. At that time, I didn't know that she knew.
How awkward is it when you talk with a mother?
Awkward.
Must be weird.
What did her mom say to you, or what has been discussed?
Her mother has not said one word to me about it. I could go into details, but I won't say anything.
Yeah, don't.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
I hear you.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101.1
WRIF. Ow, you're shouting at me.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants, like Amigos and Taylor in Woodhaven.
You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's 5 best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com. It's 5 o'clock. It's time to rock with the Riff.
Weekday afternoons at 5, right here on 101 WRIF.
Your ride home rocks with Big Daddy Arthur P. Playing your Riff Rockin' Requests. Call in your Riff Rockin' Request to the Grand Poobah at 313-298-WRIF.
Email them to arthurp@wrif.com.
Hell, you can even fax them in before you ditch the office at 248-398-6219. Call for the tunes that you want to hear. Win yourself some killer Riff swag and let the ride home rock with the Riff's own Big Daddy Arthur Penhalla.
Riff is the only station letting you pick your favorites and program the station 3 times a day at noon, 5, and 9.
It's your all-request Riff Rock and Ride Home with Big Daddy Arthur P.
From the Motor City's one and only home of rock and roll.
101 WRIF.
Riff.
From Al-Qaeda, what do they have? Nothing. They've run up this debt. They've attacked the middle class and the working class. They've attacked environmental standards. They're trying to take away overtime. They've put the worst people in judgeships, these far right-wing Christian fanatics that are supposed to be judging the key issues of our country when they come before the courts. So you pull the rug out from under them, the way Richard Clark has, and man, it's it's the fury. And this is an article from The Guardian. You say The Guardian? I don't know that. What city is that in? Well, it's in London, England. That's the problem. We don't have the proper reporting in this country because we have this big corporate media that's all in bed with Pushko. Now, here's what it said. This is from Monday. Sorry, it's Monday here too. No, I didn't say. I got to give our official designation. This is WRIF in Detroit. I'm Peter Werbe. It's a night call show. Richard Clark, the former terrorism advisor whose revelations threatened to torpedo George Bush's reelection strategy, launched a counterattack yesterday at a White House that he said was determined to destroy him. Well, that's certainly true. In a riveting television performance, Mr. Clark called on his principal critic and former employer, the National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, to release the entire record of their emails in the months up to September 11th terror attacks to prove his contention that the White House did not then take the threat of Al-Qaeda seriously. Clark also agreed to Republican demands to declassify testimony he gave to the Senate 2 years ago to prove there were no inconsistencies. Clark said on NBC television, "Let's take all of my emails and all the memos I sent to the National Security Advisor and her deputy from January 20th to September 11th, and let's declassify all of them." Condoleezza Rice is refusing to testify publicly. She can go on 60 Minutes and say all this baloney, but she's not under oath and speaking publicly. How about a debate between the two of them? Now, so vile and vicious is Bushco that they've been floating these rumors that Clark is motivated by racism. That because Condoleezza Rice is an African-American woman, that's why he's fabricated all of this information that is... Not a bit of it is true. I mean, is that what they're saying? Essentially, that's what they're saying. The 180-degree opposite of what Richard Clark asserts in Against All Enemies is absolutely false. That he wrote a book of lies. That the opposite was true. Because he's a racist. These Bushco operatives are a vile lot. They should be swept from the public scene. One Bushy that I had the misfortune of running into on Friday night was at an ACLU event. That took place on Friday night at the Wayne State University Law School, and I was on a panel along with my pal Jeremy Vose, the editor of the weekly Metro Times, a wonderful woman. I'm complimenting a politician, Joanne Watson of the Detroit City Council. Man, I can't remember the last time I was impressed by any politician. She is really something. And Celeste Headley of WDET. Wasn't there somebody? Oh, yeah. And then Nolan Finley. Nolan Finley is the editor of the editorial page. He writes those far right-wing editorials that appear in this city that is overwhelmingly liberal, in this area that's overwhelmingly liberal, in this state that's liberal. I mean, you know, it's freedom of the press. He's right to do has the right to do it, but it shows you the positioning of corporate media. Now, and here was the subject matter. We were supposed to be discussing, has the concentration of ownership of media over the last 10 years affected the quality of news? Now, this is a liberal tenet that because of Rupert Murdoch and the rest of these characters and also the Clinton bill, the Telecommunications Act, which has allowed this greater concentration of media, that now we're not getting good information. We're not getting the, quote, truth. We're not getting a full analysis of what we need in a democratic society to make our decisions. And all liberals say this. And that's why we, you know, don't get the truth about Iraq. And this is why we don't get the truth about jobs. And this is why we don't get the truth about the environment. Because these conservative media moguls control it all. Now, the only person, up until me, that said this wasn't true was Nolan Finley. Who, of course, is just this media whore and, you know, works for his boss and wouldn't say anything different. And works for Gannett, one of the most vicious media companies in the country that has just destroyed more independent newspapers than is imaginable. He said, no, it hasn't affected the quality of news at all. And then they looked at me, and I was supposed to probably deliver the knockout blow to say, yes, it was, and you can go back to Ben Bedikian's study to show that, you know, 20 years, blah, blah, blah. I said, no, this man is right. The news sucked before all this began with great intensity, this concentration of media, and it sucks today. That every issue And I use the Detroit News. Detroit News has been lying about every, well, I mean, let me put it this way. It's repeated every government lie for, you know, the hour it's been in business. It lied about the Spanish-American War in 1998. It lied about the First World War. It supported the repression of labor unions and the deportation of foreigners at the end of World War One. It repeated every government lie about the Vietnam War and the same thing about Iraq. It was Nolan Finley that was urging on our young men and women to attack Iraq on the basis of a lie about weapons of mass destruction. So I said that his paper was written in an eighth grade reading comprehension level for people with a fourth grade political comprehension level. I said it was pap for the proles. Remember the proles in 1984, with the same purpose, to garner support for Big Brother. And I just went on. I mean, those are some of the nicer things I said. So he said he had to leave at 10 after 7 from the Wayne State University Forum at the law school. And so I looked at the clock, he was the moderator was sitting between us. And I saw someone else was talking. I said, "Hey, Nolan, it's 10 after 7. And he looks at me and he says, "F you." And the moderator and someone else, she said, "Did he just say what I think he said?" Yeah. Well, Nolan, you creep, I saved my strike sign from the newspaper strike that says no news or free press wanted here. Man, I got to get this out. What a reprehensible character this guy is. All right, let's go back to our phones. Line 5 is what is. Thank you for your patience tonight, by the way. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter, this is Doug Goddard. I called. I was a guy a couple months ago who's got the rolling billboard.
Oh, yeah.
Doug,
remind people what that is.
Okay, well, I drive a little car that gets 40 miles a gallon because, you know, I can't afford the gas. And I've got it. It's red, and it's got bumper stickers, and not too gaudy, but it's noticeable. I've got a sign on it now that says, you know, Iraq cost, or no, George Bush got credit. His buddies got rich, and our young are dying, and we get the bill.
Yeah. Wow, you got that all on what, on your back window?
Yeah, on the side window. And then on the side window, I said, "America has the best health care that no one can afford."
Well.
You know? And, of course, I got bumper stickers that I've had made up that says, "George Bush is one bad, you know, cowboy, but as long as he ain't doing the fighting."
Yeah, he scared. You know, you ever think about this, Doug?
Wait.
You ever think about this? He scams out of all this stuff. Whatever happened to this stuff about how he scammed out of the military?
Oh yeah. Well, you talked about that a couple weeks ago on the show. What I wanted to bring up tonight is I just got done with a book, The House of Bush, The House of Saud.
Oh yeah. Very important book.
Have you read it?
No, I haven't, but
oh, my gosh. I'm making some bullet points up because there's so much information in this thing that is just amazing. If I may, just let me run this by you.
Go ahead.
Okay. One of the biggest facts in this whole thing is March 28, 2002, Pakistani commandos and American Special Forces raided a house in Pakistan, and they got this guy named Jim Zabata.
Yeah.
And okay, so he was supposed to be one of the top Iraqi planners. I mean,
mm-hmm.
Al Qaeda planners. I'm sorry, I'm getting kind of nervous. He was shot 3 times in the raid, and they got him patched up, and they started using sodium pentothal. Well, they did the good cop, bad cop routine on him, and the first American team was like the American team, and the second American team was like our Arabian Americans.
Yeah.
Okay, but they were like the Saudis. They played them up like they were the Saudi intelligence, and they sent these guys in thinking that they talked to the Americans because we're pretty we're not going to be as hard on them as the Saudis, being as they have the chop-chop square in Riyadh. You know, if you get tried in Saudi Arabia, they don't mess around. They chop your head off. Anyway,
Doug, this story is getting on a bit much. Let me just say that that's a very, very important book to show the relationship between the Bush family and the Saudis, and could be one of the reasons that, in fact, that's one of the things that that O'Neill, the FBI agent, charged that that Bush refused to investigate him. It was because of that connection. Where should we look for your car? Where do you usually drive?
I live south of Monroe.
Yeah,
and I go into Livonia every day. I work at one of the big three. I'm in a work in engineering.
How do your fellow workers relate to all that?
Oh, you know, I work with these guys. I take a lot of graft because I'm a 70s ex hippie liberal that's, you know, made good. My kids are all raised, and I don't want anyone messing with me, and I don't want to mess with anybody. A lot of these guys are diehard hunters and NRA, and I'm against that. And I'm not against hunting. I'm against, you know, having guns just to have guns.
Well, wait a minute. Don't tell me there's like UAW workers that are going to vote for Bush?
It's scary. Me and my wife have been talking about this. You know, these guys are just, they love this guy.
They must be absolute idiots. Doug, let's leave it at that. I have to move on and get some more calls. Thank you very much. Now, I didn't know this. Somebody just wrote in and told me this. One of the best talk show hosts in America, Mike Malloy, M-A-L-L-O-Y. Go to MikeMalloy.com, who no longer is on the air, unfortunately. This is what Mike, in fact, you could say that I like George W. Bush compared to Mike. Mike is over the edge. It's one of the reasons that he has trouble getting a job. I mean, if you're a right-wing psycho, he'd probably say he's a left-wing psycho. But if you're a right-wing psycho, you can say anything you want about anything. You can threaten. I mean, I heard a guy in Detroit threatening liberals with death. I did. Imagine if I did something like that. Anyway. Here is what Mike Malloy used to say about this administration. God should pinch their heads off and toss them into hell so the demons could use them as soccer balls. I love it. They deserve it, too. They've made a mess of everything. They are the worst possible people that have been at the head of this country, maybe since its origins. Wow. A revolution in 1776 for Dick Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush. Whew. All right. Where are we going? Line four? Okay. Thank you. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. My name is Kathy. I'm calling from Massachusetts.
Oh, hi, Kathy.
How are you?
I'm well. What city in Massachusetts?
I'm from the People's Republic of Cambridge.
Oh.
And I have to listen to internet radio because there's no liberal talk radio in Boston, if you can believe that.
That's insane, isn't it? Well, the same thing's true with Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, it's to the point where we're just, you know, I have to listen on the internet. There's nothing here. I mean, in NPR, I consider middle and almost to the right these days. I mean, their reporting is hardly fair and balanced.
Well, I don't know. I actually chickened out. I don't know if you heard me talking earlier. I was on this panel with somebody from the local NPR station, and I didn't want to tell her that in the run-up to the war and during the Iraq war that we used to refer to NPR as nationalistic puppet radio and what was the other thing? National Pentagon radio.
I actually heard a caller on one of their afternoon shows call it that before the censor could get out of there.
Really?
I was laughing. I was in traffic. It was fairly funny. But I want to go back a couple. I think it was the caller before the last one who was talking how you weren't fair and balanced, and I was like, how can he say that with the like of, you know, Rush Limbaugh, the three-hour hate monger, and Sean Hannity on the air?
Well, you could argue that we're all guilty of being one-sided. But what's wrong with being one-sided? I don't get that. Where, I mean, it's like this myth of objectivity that media poses itself as, particularly the newspapers and the you know, like everybody from NBC to ABC to Fox and CNN. There's a political position inherent in whatever you're saying. I mean, you could say, what am I supposed to say? Bush is awful, evil, vile, terrible, mean, stupid. But then on the other hand, he's nice, compassionate, smart, and a good administrator? I mean,
well,
how do I do that?
You can't, because he's the former and not the latter.
Well, yeah.
I also wanted to, he's the caller, obviously. I'm in the middle of Richard Clark's book, and I've seen him on TV recently. And one of the things is, you know, obviously the Bush administration and a lot of the right-wingers are trying to spin it that it was Clinton's fault. But not only do other sources corroborate what Richard Clark's saying, including Paul O'Neill, like you mentioned, including George Tenet, including a lot of intelligence sources, that Clinton was obsessed with getting bin Laden. He, in 1996, he tried to get Congress to push to freeze overseas accounts of suspected terrorists, but unfortunately Phil Graham and the Republicans were like, no way, because that would hurt their Enron buddies. He was, during that whole Monica scandal, he wanted to bomb the Afghan terrorist camps, and he did. And, of course, the Republicans were saying, oh, wag the dog to deflect attention away from Monica, et cetera. But again, you know, all these other sources. I mean, Richard Clark, you can just tell he's a stand-up guy. He's a no, you know, take no prisoners, real straightforward. And compared to this administration, that's all they've been doing is spinning and spinning and spinning since the minute he started talking out. I mean, he is, I mean, I think he's a true American patriot because he puts his country before his party.
Sure. Absolutely. I was looking at this one right-wing website, and it actually has dropped a lot of its, I'm not even going to give its name, but it says, Clark to earn over $1 million for book, contract has bonuses added. Well, I mean, aren't the Republicans the big capitalists?
Yeah.
And now, they're saying he should give his profits to the victims of 9/11. Well, last I heard...
He was.
What, really?
Yeah, I heard that he was going to give part of the proceeds to, like, people who went... families of soldiers that went into Afghanistan. He said that on Meet the Press this morning.
Yeah, well, because I was going to say, there's this enormous fund for survivors of September 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, hey, I'm going to be out your way just vacationing a little while. I don't know. I mean, if I, in Boston, I don't know if I dare step into the People's Republic of Cambridge.
Well, it's a wonderful place. This is a little oasis here. I think you live in a very liberal area, though, too. So,
yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, lots of like-minded people, lots of culture, lots of fun. I think you'll enjoy yourself. Are you going to the ocean or?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
All right. Thank you, Kelly.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks for calling in from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yeah, we're starting to get callers from all around the country. Got a couple other, let me see here. I wonder if I should bring this up. Well, okay, there's a couple of open lines. If we've exhausted this subject, I will introduce another. Here we are. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, what's going on, Pete? It's Mike over at Marvin Square's house.
Hi, Mike.
How you doing, bud?
Good.
Listen, a couple of things. That woman that was on the phone earlier for that Show Us the Jobs tour or whatever, she was talking about that plant that's out there in Greenville that does the... they manufacture parts for sewing machines and vacuum cleaners.
Right.
I think they're only losing about 600 jobs to Mexico. The rest of the ones are all moving down to South Carolina. Have you heard what Jennifer Granholm's plan is to fix the economy here in the state of Michigan?
No.
You know, the cool and hip cities thing? She wants to take, She wants to take tax dollars from the entire state, reinvest it into 10, maybe 15 cities here in the state of Michigan, to make them cool and hip to attract young, high-tech workers into the state that, obviously, according to her, there are no jobs here for. Doesn't that seem a little silly to you?
Well, it does. And if people aren't going to address how much taxes we're paying and where it's going, we're never going to get anywhere. I mean, when one thing I don't do, I'm remiss at, I should just make a list of every shortfall in every budget for every city and every school district and every road commission where Bush's buddies are getting wealthy. I mean, think about, apparently the gas has hit $3 a gallon in California, and I see it now for regular $1.79. here in the Detroit area. And in the meantime, Bush's buddies are making a fortune in these oil companies.
My buddy was just out in California. He said he paid $2.40 a gallon, which is a lot. But for California, the gas tax out there is pretty high. But back to my point about the job situation here in Michigan, you know, it's kind of funny that the three states that have the highest unemployment rate in the country, which I think, depending on which survey you look at, are Michigan, California, and I believe Washington, have the highest tax rates. The lowest unemployment rates are the states in this country that have the lowest taxes. I don't know if you heard John Kerry's speech the other day when he was here in town. He was in Warren speaking on Friday. His plan to rebuild, you know, to create more jobs in this country, which I find this really funny. He's going to lower the corporate tax rate.
Well, what is up with this guy? I mean, he's another corporatist. I think one could probably do a Green Party kind of comparison between Bush and Kerry, just like the Greens did between Gore and Bush, and wind up not being very happy with the Democratic Party candidate. But to me, defeating Bush, if for no other reason to wipe the smirk off the chimp's face, that in and of itself would be reward enough. But we are not going to achieve heaven or nirvana or paradise when John Kerry sends George Bush back to Crawford, if that's what you're getting at.
No, that's not at all what I'm getting at. My whole point is, it seems kind of funny to me that Kerry's going to drop the taxes when all the Bush tax cuts have pretty much gone to corporations.
Right.
And you can put whatever spin on him as how as they, you know, affect the rich people or whatever. But if he's going to drop the top corporate tax rate, do you think this is going to alienate him with, you know, the fringe anti-corporate left voters? Do you think?
Well, I don't know that it's a fringe anti-left voter. I mean, I don't even like that kind of language to describe people that understand that that massive wealth in this country acts to the detriment of the entire middle class and the entire working class. In other words, the vast majority of the American public. And you can see that in all the polls. But what Kerry risk doing is, in fact, to alienate people who would be his in-the-trenches workers that would be out there pounding the hustings, getting people out to vote. And if he starts coming on like George Bush light when it comes to the economy, people are just going to stay home and say the hell with it. Most people do anyways. If you think about after all this tumult and hullabaloo, what was it last time? Almost 50% of the people in 2000 stayed home. So we'll see what happens next. Thanks, Mike. Appreciate your call. Here's what John in Ferndale wrote to me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Matt Drudge is ragging on the Democrats for the current 911 investigation. He's complaining that it's politically motivated. He thinks that we have this commission to discover what happened on September 11th is politically motivated. John from Ferndale says, what an ass. How about that farce of an impeachment against Clinton? So, what sauce for the goose, sauce for the gander? They sure don't want to buy that. Where are we going next? Thank you, Rick. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Peter.
Hi.
Was there ever a final accounting of how much money Kenneth Starr had in the budget to investigate Clinton?
I don't know. Wasn't it like $60 or $70 million of our tax money?
Well, couldn't we have used that money pre-9/11 for intelligence?
Yeah, well, think about the word you just used.
And another thing, if anyone in the listening audience has any information about what Condoleezza Rice's true sexual preference is, I would like to know. Thank you.
Well, I don't know. What do we care about that? Here's what David writes in the call talk, yes, at yahoo.com. No city. Bushco condemns Clark for taking advantage of September 11th, yet they went to Iraq so they could capture bin Laden during the 2004 campaign. I think they did Hussein just to measure the political bounce. Also, they want to see how long the bounce will last. Gas was under a dollar a gallon right before they seized power, right before Bush seized power. Huh. You're right. I remember I got gas, I think it was like for 89 cents, not too long, about maybe 5 years ago or so, in a gas station on the corner of the Lodge and Livernois. They want to, oh yeah, gas was under a dollar right before Bush seized power. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to connect these dots. Watch out for Bushko to take control of the internet next, since it's the only place liberals can organize. Friday, he said he wants the whole country hooked up to broadband. Translation of this is he wants a few big corporations to control the internet. Oh, you're so cynical, but probably absolutely accurate. We will continue. All right, we'll take one more call before we go to our break. 313-298-WRIF. Email to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Peter Werbe, PETERWERBE.com for website. Find a lot of the stuff I've been talking about there. You know, go into articles. And at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, if you're listening somewhere else in the country or the world, doing a couple articles. One by, this is, we're going to kind of move away from all that and talk about our kids. How about that? And some of you are kids, so you don't have kids, but you may find this interesting as well. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Peter. This is a fringe left-wing anti-corporate voter in Kenosha, Wisconsin calling.
Hi, how you doing? What's your name?
My name's James.
Hey, James.
How you doing?
Well.
This is in reference to an earlier caller who took you to task for not presenting both sides of the issue.
Uh-huh.
And my question for him would be, what is the other side? I mean, if the argument is being made that the Bush administration was asleep at the wheel on 9-1-1, then the other side would have to be, oh, no, we were absolutely, completely on top of the game, and there's no evidence to support that. What they present as the other side is, well, what did Clinton do? That's not the other side of the argument.
No.
And so it's a totally bogus argument, which, of course, we know they've been laying out there regarding Clinton. They won't let Clinton leave office is the bottom line. I think you do if you present all sides. My other side, and I think this is another side, but it's heresy, is that the war on terrorism is completely bogus.
Oh, yeah. It's another way to spend taxpayer money and not getting much bang for our buck. Well, think about how much does the war in Iraq cost already? About $130 billion. And one of our goals is supposed to be capturing Osama bin Laden. What if we would have taken all of that money and all those troops and used them in an Afghanistan? I'm not even suggesting that necessarily. That has some really negative aspects to it as well. But this, the Iraq war is this total diversion from the war on terror.
Well, I don't believe there is a war on terror. I think any more so than you could say the war on poverty, eradicated poverty.
Or the war on drugs.
The war on drugs is a huge example. The war on illiteracy, we still have illiterate citizens. But when you cast something as a war on, it does one. Speaking of which, a great comic strip, Get Your War On. It casts it as, we are really serious about this, folks. That's one. And two, it opens the door, it justifies all sorts of actions that would be completely out of the realm under other circumstances, from things like the Patriot Act to diverting the tax money into the coffers of those corporations. Everything under the sun comes under the war on. And whereas if you had said, you know, Bush makes a joke out of this one on the campaign, his stump speech now. He talks about, and John Kerry would not call this a war. What he would say, this is a police action. We should issue a summons for Osama bin Laden. Ha, ha, ha. It's really funny, except for the fact is that we have been successfully, the world has been successfully capturing international criminals of all stripes by doing exactly that and hauling them in.
Sure, police work. Well, I'm just repeating what both of us said, but whenever you hear war on, you know that it's a government racket that takes money from the citizens under the guise of some great need and turns it over to private entrepreneurs who wind up working for the government. I got to go, James, but let me ask you one question before we go, and I've been thinking about this. If there's another terrorist attack in the United States, do you think this will work for Bush or against Bush? That's difficult because you got the people might flock to him more, or it might be the example of Spain.
I don't believe that it. I guess it would depend on the nature of the attack. But my feeling after the Clark debacle, and if you watched all of the 60 Minutes program, including Leslie Stahl reading the viewer emails at the end, that said,
why can't you be more like Fox News, fair and balanced? And Richard Clark should be tried for treason and shot, taken out and shot. After this, I don't believe there's anything that's going to change the position of either side. And another war, another terrorist attack, if anything, might bring a few more over to the Bush side just because we would be in mourning. And it's hard to be stridently opposed to the sitting president when you're in mourning over citizens.
Well, but think about Spain. They knew that they'd been lied to by the conservative Spanish government, and that they realized that the involvement of Spain in war in Iraq had set them up for what happened in Madrid. So I don't know. Well, we will see.
They were 80% opposed to the war prior to the election, and we're
right.
not in that position.
Now we are. Well, we will see as it goes along. These people are notorious for engineering stunts at a particular point where it's necessary, where when their ratings are going down. So I dread what they have up their evil sleeves.
About canceling the presidential election.
Well, that would be one thing if Bush's if all of this really becomes exposed, and if we start to sustain major losses in Iraq. Then all of a sudden there was a terror attack. Well, hey, we can't hold the 2004 election. I think I mentioned this one other time. I had played this documentary on this station about the coup in Chile that was engineered by the United States, Richard Nixon, and that other war criminal, Henry Kissinger. And I knew the details, and I thought it was be interesting for our listeners to hear it, but. The only thing that startled me was that so many people said they were shocked that this coup in Chile occurred, that they had something like 150 years of unbroken democratic rule, and that even when the coup occurred, they thought, well, the military was angry because there was this left-wing government that had been voted in to office, and that they thought that this would end quickly. The ferocity of it, the nature of the repression, and how long Chilean fascism lasted really was shocking to them. And one of the things that happens, you don't get a telegram saying, well, sorry, we're canceling the elections, and suddenly this empire run by Bushko is going to be administered on that basis, that we've made the transformation as Rome did in its as it began to slowly collapse from republic to empire. So we'll see.
You know, the interesting thing is Tommy Franks actually was quoted as saying that if America came under another serious attack on our soil and resulted in massive casualties, that his opinion, the Constitution would be set aside and we would go to martial law.
You know where he said that, James?
Pardon me?
You know where he said that?
I can find it for you and email you the link.
I know where he, actually I know where he said it in Cigar Aficionado magazine. And you're,
I'm sorry, I quoted a pretty lousy source there.
Yeah, well, you're paraphrasing because he had, because he had an interesting word that you left out.
Okay.
He said this would end our experiment in constitutional government.
You sure they were cigars, then?
Yeah. All right.
But, I love the show. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling in from Kenosha, Wisconsin. I appreciate it. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
Okay, so now my friend Gary wants to buy a motorcycle, and he's into foreign models. At first, I thought he was talking about fashion supermodels from Sweden or something.
Yeah, I am Erki. I am one fashion model.
But no, he's talking about motorcycles with names like Yamasushi.
You'll be here 4 hours! You'll go home now!
I tell him, buy American Muscle, buy a Harley Davidson motorcycle! You know, all our friends told Gary, buy a bike in Motown, buy a bike in Motown! So Gary, who's been eating too much Yamasushi lately, decides to shop for a rice burner. Those other dealers told him low prices, but when he said how much they're worth in a year, Gary's head exploded. Then I take my friend Gary to Motown Harley Davidson and Taylor. They tell Larry, resale value tomorrow, good luck today. And he says, no way. And they say, like today. And he says, no way. And they say, like today. And Larry says, okay. And now we are riding our Harleys, and Gary has an American model between his legs and a Swedish supermodel between his sheets.
Yeah, I like on scrambled eggs in the morning.
Don't you think that if they're called supermodels, they should have like a cape and blue tights and X-ray vision or something?
He ain't!
For sales, specials events, or just to look at cool pictures, log on to MotownHarley.com. Motown Harley Davidson in Taylor on Telegraph, just north of Eureka.
Remember, guys, chick stick a guy on the real motorcycle. Buy a bike at Motown! Okay.
It's party time. Get a real feel of erotic image featuring Michigan's hottest male and female strippers.
strippers.
Add the stripper to any party and watch your party come alive.
Erotic Image delivers the sexiest and most seductive entertainers right to your doorstep or wherever the party's at.
For your next bachelor, bachelorette, birthday, or any party occasion, give the gift that unwraps itself. Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, the name that says it all. Sexy, provocative, outrageous, but all in good fun.
Erotic Image, 888-41-STRIP.
Surf Erotic Image at eroticimage.com, the official home of Brutal Betty, the Erotic Image dream girls, the incredible hunks of Men in Motion, and those naughty awesome twosomes, the wild girly girls. Due to popular demand, Erotic Image has hosts and hostesses to kick off your party. Try one.
Go online and explore the Erotic Image Cyber Showcase. View the dancers, check their prices, and place your order online.
Erotic Image, where image is expertise, and the experience is always erotic.
Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP. That's 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, where image is everything.
Do you feel like half the man you used to be? Do you feel tired and irritable? Are you losing your sex drive? If so, you could have low testosterone.
I'm Dr. Richard Cohen, MD, men's health specialist. Testosterone levels can fall rapidly after age 35, but now you can boost your testosterone naturally. Introducing Testostazine, the powerful new testosterone-boosting system I developed for men who are starting to feel their age. Testostazine supports your body's ability to produce testosterone the way you did when you were younger, so you can restore your energy, youthful sex drive, and staying power. Testosterone keeps a man energetic and sexually confident. You can feel that way no matter what your age. Testostazine can help.
Call now for your risk-free confidential trial of testosterone. Call 1-800-807-8108. 1-800-807-8108. Guaranteed to work for you or your money back. Call 1-800-807-8108. Results will vary.
Get a free chance to win Club Keno with Extra Shot.
Oh, hi, dilly, 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 do. Oh, I love to play Club Keno.
I play it with me friends.
We're always at our favorite place.
The good play never ends.
Club Keno is exciting.
Club Keno makes me grin.
I love to pick me numbers.
As for me, I love to win.
Oh, hi, dilly, 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 do.
Hey, what could be more exciting than playing Michigan Lottery's Club Keno? How about an extra shot at winning on the house? Now through April 25th, buy a Club Keno ticket for the next five drawings, and you'll get a free $1 easy pick for the current drawing. That's Extra Shot.
I went to play Club Keno, and all my friends were there.
We ate, we drank, we laughed a lot.
The cheer was everywhere.
I picked my favorite numbers.
I waited for the draw.
When they came up, I won some cash.
Next time, I'll bring me mom.
Club Keno Extra Shot. Buy five draws, get one free.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
All right, thank you very much. About another 20 minutes, and then we'll go to our interviews. I just don't know what to do. I've got just absolutely terrific emails. Got all of you folks on hold here. And, I did want to say a special hello to people at DemocraticUnderground.com. DemocraticUnderground.com. They listen on Sundays around the country. And so those are good folks, good website as well. Let's go to our phones, and then I'll read some more of those. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
I'm a first-time caller, but I've known you, and I've been around you many times. And I want to tell you that I look at Bush on both sides of the coin. On the one side, I look at his treachery and deceit and manipulation. And on the other side, I look at how he's leading this country to destruction and is against the working man, and his health care is a complete bogus thing. And that's my way of looking at it. And that other guy that called a few calls back, and he said, you've got to be fair. You know, got to show both sides of the coin.
Right.
Well, I believe that in being a critic of what he's done, how can you come to any conclusion but that he's, I call him a monster and a gangster, but that's how I look at him.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for your opinion. Here, Jeff in Ypsilanti says, a couple of interesting statistics from Harper's Magazine. Percentage of U.S. voters whose 2004 vote will be cast via computer system producing no paper record, 29%. percentage change in Mexico's inflation-adjusted minimum wage since the implementation of NAFTA, 21%. So that's down. Wow. All right, let's take another national caller. It's Billy from Santa Cruz, California. Billy, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Just checking in with the California opinion on everything at all.
California dreaming.
That's right.
Yeah, and a little hot out. A little hot out there, isn't it?
It really is. I'm worried about the global warming again.
Yeah.
Like there's not enough to worry about. Oh my God.
Right.
You know, Peter, it's pretty obvious that anybody who isn't part of the cult feels the same way about this guy.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, that's it. It's either you're part of the Bush religion, or you're going to vote against them in the fall.
Do you remember, by any chance, from history in 1932, what percentage of the vote that Hitler got?
No.
About a third. About a third of the country. Actually,
1932.
In the last free election, actually, the left vote, the socialists and the communists had, I forgot what it was, 40 something. So they are actually, if they would have run a unity candidate, we wouldn't have had the history that we did. But there's a third of the population that is filled with hate. It loves leaders. The more vicious and threatening they are, the more warlike, the more they're going to signal their allegiance.
It's the father thing.
Yeah, it is.
Wow, you know, it's so easy to understand conservatives, having watched them now for a little while. And it's really completely about flaw in character, not about the philosophy of ideas at all.
Ultimately, no. You're right.
You know, they're just mostly fearful and a little cruel.
And they despise anyone who dissents. They want this hierarchy. They love this pyramid. The leader is at the point, and then they, the faithful followers, down the ladder. And anyone that dares to say no, or I don't think that's a good idea, I don't know if you heard me earlier, I was saying there was this talk show host in Detroit saying, they ought to string up socialists! And I'm thinking, What all nine of them in Detroit? So who he's talking about are essentially liberals. He's threatening with death.
Oh, that's absolutely where it's at. You know, when Bush stole the last election, I remember hearing them finally say, you know, either the Democrats go away or they got to remember we're the one with all the guns.
Yeah.
You know.
They're scary.
Well, they are. And the thing is that fear will provoke the kind of reaction that we're most afraid of. And that's the whole thing, is the conservatives don't understand what really is the best part of America. That's the part they're in denial about.
Yeah,
the free speech thing. You know, the fact that they, you know, it's like, watch out what you say was the message from the presidential publicist at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Careful what you say.
Well, they all have what pre-fascist tendencies, and the conservatives, of course, always in every country where fascism arose, from Japan, Italy, Germany, Spain, the conservatives always embrace the fascist without reservations. And you can see this in the language. You can see this when someone, some talk show host in Detroit talks about destroying physically people he disagrees with. You hear it in a guy that wrote me, a veteran, and told me, you should just shut up. In other words, I shouldn't speak. And he was telling me how he defended democracy and then tells me to shut up. I mean, I thought,
we improve on the product that is America if we don't fix it when it gets a little broken. You know, the first chip they invented was pretty damn slow. Now they go a million times faster. You got to be willing to criticize, make it better, and move on. It's called, what is it called? When you move forward. Oh, progressivism.
There you go. Well, I don't know if you've heard me, Billy, and I meant to say this at the beginning of the show. I ought to do this every week. That I challenge anybody to come up with I'm trying to rephrase this simply. The conservatives have opposed every move forward in democracy. Remember I always say that they opposed the American Revolution.
That's right.
Finally, when it got established, they opposed anybody voting beyond white propertied males. They supported slavery.
Yeah.
They opposed the vote for women.
Right.
They supported segregation.
Right.
They opposed the union movement.
Mixed race marriage.
Yeah, everything under the sun. So I was saying, name one social act or one, so what's the word I'm looking for?
Move forward in freedom.
Yeah.
Extending further freedoms to us all. Suffrage.
Never.
Universal suffrage.
They are always on the other side. See, it always looks like we're losing, but Howard Zinn, the great American historian, said, we lose every battle, but we win every war. So that's good. Billy, I got to move on.
Thank you, buddy.
All right. Enjoy yourself out there. California with record temperatures. Ryan from Redford wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. There was a caller earlier who said I wasn't presenting both sides. And Ryan says, I wanted to state that taking a balanced view is usually contradicting instead of being fair. What the middle doesn't understand is that every topic is tied into the other. And Ryan says, for example, if you support Bush's tax cuts and support small business growth, you would be completely working against yourself. So if you don't take a side, you are either confused or thoughtless or brainless. Moving on. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Yeah, hi, Peter. This is Lou from Royal Oak.
Hi, Lou.
Hi. I recall a couple years ago you brought up a very interesting poll. I think it was Times Newsweek or in the year 2000. Before the election, they queried voters, and 19% of them thought that they were in the top 1% of income distribution.
Oh, yeah.
And another 20% thought that they soon would be.
Yeah, actually, that was just last year, Lou.
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
In any case, when the media have the ability to skew people's perception and get them thinking that they are part of the ruling elite instead of the proles, as you call them, how do you get through? I mean, the Republicans have got 10 years of job growth planned, but they're going to be in Mick jobs, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics.
They're going to be what jobs?
Mick jobs.
Mick? Oh, Mick jobs. Yeah, yeah. Mick jobs, like right. At McDonald's, right.
Yeah, and students in some of the tech fields, like computing science and electrical engineering, are voting with their feet, and I think enrollments in the last couple of years are down like 30%, even at MIT.
So, well, I don't know. I mean, I just keep chipping away. I mean, one of the things that you see, that if you have actually a fair and balanced press, like in England, the majority of people wind up opposing the war. If you have a oppositional press, like in Spain, 80 to 90% of the people oppose the war in Iraq. When you have a media that is no different than Pravda and Izvestia in the old Soviet Union, well, still, you had a fairly big split. And can you imagine that if there would have been a real fair and balanced press, and that when the statements that now we know were just total BS were uttered by Bush Co. and the people in the administration, that if there would have been an equal voice given to the opposition, we would never have been in this mess in Iraq to begin with, because people would have said, well, wait a minute. Yeah, what they're saying is a load of crap.
Yeah, if we had a balanced media, but I guess my question is this. I know you support Kerry, and you regard him as better than Bush, but if you read like Paul Krugman, for example, he indicates that the winner of the next election is going to wind up with a big economic albatross hung
sure.
around his neck.
Well, I'm sure that there's a Bush-Co fallback strategy, is that the economy is going to be so wrecked, and that Bush-Co has set the stage for increased terrorism and probably a defeat in Iraq eventually. And I'm calling myself a Kerry supporter really stretches my feelings towards the man in terms of a description of me. But that this just sets the stage for Michael. If you go for the Corleone, I mean, we have Fredo in power now, right?
Right.
So then it'll finally go down to Michael to be the godfather. So I think they've got a lot of long-range strategies, and they're not going to let anything like the defeat of Bush in an honest election in 2004. And an honest election, can you imagine that? All right, thank you, Lou.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for calling us. Roy in Placitas, New Mexico writes, proof the White House is either lying or incompetent. Roy says, if Richard Clark, the author of Against All Enemies, was doing a good job at the White House, was doing a good job, the White House is lying. If he was doing the job as badly and incompetently as they're trying to portray, they are totally incompetent for not firing him and letting the world know why. So you get that? I mean, that's actually good reasoning, Roy. If Clark was doing a good job at the White House, then everything the White House is saying about him is a lie. If he was doing such a poor job that he was so bad, so terrible, as they're now letting on, why did they have him on as the advisor on terrorism? Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Pete. This is Luther in Troy.
Hi, Luther.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm glad that you're on the air. And, you know, there aren't many liberal or liberal-leaning radio people going on right now. And I heard that Al Franken's actually getting the show this next week.
They are starting. Yeah, they are.
But it's only going to be in limited cities and stuff like that. I don't know. I'd like to listen to it before I do anything about it. But I'd hope that it could get to more cities. And I was wondering, you said Greater Media is in Boston?
Greater Media is the corporation that I work for. This is Greater Media Detroit, okay. WRIF, and two other stations. And the corporate headquarters is in Boston.
Okay. Well, I was just wondering about that, and also one other thing. I heard something the other day. Maybe you can tell me more about it, but I heard some ruling happened down in New Orleans someplace where they ruled in favor of, you know, changing the rules as far as use of, you know, search warrants.
Yeah.
And I guess it was in relation to, you know, protecting the police officers is the way that is a reason why they shouldn't have to go through getting search warrants.
Well, I actually didn't hear anything about it, and sometimes local courts or even federal district courts will make some ruling, and I'll look into it, though. All right, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. And thanks to all of you for listening and calling tonight. As usual, an energetic discussion. You can email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. If you have more comments, I'll check them out tomorrow. My website, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com. Stay tuned for the interviews.
Whose motorcycle is this?
It's a chopper, baby.
This Wednesday night, the Riff and Wild Woodies are proud to bring you the Miss Detroit Choppers Calendar Girl Competition.
From the ceiling to the dance floor, Wild Woodies is bursting at the seams with the most outrageous people, the hottest beats, and an insane atmosphere you won't find anywhere else.
Rev up your engine and join WRIF's Ann Carlini this Wednesday night as the Detroit Choppers check out Metro Detroit's lovely ladies to be on their calendar and give away cash and prizes.
Wednesday night is also ladies' night. That means no cover and drink specials for ladies 18 and up.
Stay late and join the uninhibited elite and Metro Detroit's most beautiful people packing the room to capacity for the hottest Wednesday night dance party around.
Sponsored by Tycoon.
This Wednesday night, the Riff and Wild Woodies want you to enjoy the ride as the Detroit Choppers look for their new calendar girls.
Wild Woodies on Gratiot, just off I-94 in downtown Roseville.
Wild Woodies.
You've waited long enough. Sitting at your desk planning your approach, you know things would be so much better than how it is now. You just need that one thing in your life that would be complete. You know you're not happy. Stop sitting there and make your move. This spring, you get the career you've spent hours dreaming about at the office. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts is exactly the next move you need to make to turn those dreams into reality. Hey, this is Screaming Scott Randall from The Riff, and I've got the greatest job in the world because I gave Specs a call. Before The Riff came into my life, I was right where you are now. Tried fast food, tried factory work. All I needed was a little courage to make the move that would change my life for good. And the spring fling is all you can handle now. No worries, my friend. All you need to do is give Specs Howard a call. 248-358-9000 by April 30th to set up a date. Just take a tour of the school and check things out. There's zero commitment. This is your life. Do you really want to spend another unfulfilling year handing out tacos, sweeping the floor, getting some dude a cup of coffee? No! Don't wait. Spring classes are forming now. And of course, morning, afternoon, and evening options are available. Call 248-358-9000 today. Again, 248-358-9000. Or the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. Again, 248-358-9000. Make the call today. This is where you start. It's where I started.
It's world-class racing with the world's hottest moto athletes. THQ AMA Supercross Series. Presented by American Suzuki. Sanctioned by AMA Pro Racing. Kids tread and seats are just $10. To see Supercross prodigy James Stewart race for the first time ever in the Superdome. Just $10. For superstars David Gillman, Kevin Windham, Chad Reed, and more. Just $10. for adrenaline-pumping racing. Get your tickets now at participating Michigan motorcycle dealers, the box office, Ticketmaster. Charge it at 248-645-6666 or online at Ticketmaster.com. Tickets subject to convenience and handling charges. General admission seats $2 more day of show. And make sure to get there early, because gates open at 12:30 for practice and qualifying. THQ World Supercross GP. Brought to you locally by Anderson's Honda and Subway. This Saturday at 7 in the Silverdome. Host Holiday and Select.
Men, how do you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Thank you very much for joining me on the Peter Werby Show. We've talked so many times about drugs, drug addiction, drug abuse, the so-called war against drugs, that sometimes you wonder, is there anything more to say? But since it's an ongoing problem, I think we ought to review periodically the literature, what people are saying about it, and particularly creative people, people that are suggesting solutions. So joining me today is Meredith Marin, her book is called Dirty, A Search for Answers Inside America's Teenage Drug Epidemic, and she also wrote the best-selling book, Class Dismissed. And Meredith, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Did I say your last name right? Yes, I did. We were talking about that before the broadcast, and you said rhymes with Karen, so it's Meredith Marin.
That's right.
Okay, good. Let me just ask you one thing. And the subtitle is A Search for Answers Inside America's Teenage Drug Epidemic. Do you feel comfortable with calling it an epidemic?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay.
I actually thought about that before I called the book that. But the extent of the problem is so great, as I'm sure any parent in the know will attest, that it truly is of epidemic levels.
Well, here, the only reason I was thinking about this, I think it's a big problem, and if we had 25,000 teenagers, and I know that we're lucky if we have one city in Detroit, a city like Detroit, if it only had 25,000 kids that are abusing drugs, we'd probably be advanced. But you're one of these statistics, all of which are very shocking. It says nearly 15 million Americans, half of them under age 26, are illicit drug users. So that brings it down to 13 million. What is it? 7.5 million under 26.
Right.
And then if we start getting down into 19. So I want to solve this problem, and I know you do too, and you've had some extraordinary experiences even inside your family. But I sometimes worry. That calling an epidemic, creates more of almost of a panic reaction in people.
Well, you're actually making a good point, and one of the things I always tell parents when I speak to them about Dirty is, you know, step one, relax, take a breath, because we do get in a panic whether our kids are involved in drugs, with drugs or not. There's sort of two extremes of a reaction, and one is denial. A lot of people, and I went through all of them when my son was in trouble, which is why I wrote the book. One problem is denial on one end of the spectrum, where you sort of go, no, this can't be happening to my kid. And then the other end of it is this complete panic, and neither one is really useful in helping us deal with the problem.
One thing, of course, is astounding that you bring out in your book, Dirty, is that so many American teenagers are using drugs, more so ever in the history of this country. So we've had this war on drugs. We've spent billions, some people estimate almost up towards $1 trillion. And here we have, and I think when you're into the millions, we shouldn't quibble about whether it's an epidemic or not. There's enough that it's a major problem.
Right.
How come we are, in the words of the people that put this together, losing the war on drugs?
I think mostly because in the case of adolescents, certainly, we haven't addressed the causes. And, you know, I think that if you want to figure out why we're fighting this expensive losing battle, all you have to do is follow the money. And in the case of kids, I think that the causes of teenagers using drugs and abusing drugs are really based in some fundamental problems in American society that, again, all boil down, in a way, to the money and to the priorities. And if you look at what kind of money we spend on kids in this country, everything ranging from medical care and child care all the way up through the public school system, where kids have evidence every single day that society really isn't making a big priority out of providing for them. I think that in turn creates despair in them and a sense of lack of worth that allows them to turn to whatever the momentary pleasure would be.
Meredith Marin, it's hard for me to put myself in the mind of a social or political conservative, but I've heard enough of their complaints that they probably would say, well, you want to blame it on everything in this society other than the family, the parenting,
right.
That you're creating a case for victimization, and let's get down to individual responsibility. Maybe you could answer that and at the same time tell us what happened inside of your family.
Definitely. Well, that is really, in a way, the biggest point of the book has to do with the experience that I had and that most parents have when their kids are in trouble, which is of being blamed exclusively for their kids' problems. In my case, I have two sons, and they're both doing great now. Happy ending to the story. They're now 24 and 25. But when Jesse, my younger son, was about 13, he started getting into trouble using drugs and also breaking the law, and he was committing increasingly serious crimes. And all through his adolescence, everywhere I went, the social workers, the counselors, the probation officers, the judges, the school people even were looking for someone to blame for this. And of course, I was the easy target. And what I found when I wrote Dirty is that this is all too common, and that parents who are already distraught because their kids are in trouble are then made even more sort of vulnerable and shaky by the fact that everywhere they turn, they're being blamed for their kid's problem instead of having the whole family supported, you know, in trying to solve it.
Well, the common logic would be that kids that use drugs are troubled kids, and they're troubled because of experiences within the family.
Right. And, you know, the thing is, one of the things I try to do in the book is distinguish between kids who use drugs, kids who abuse drugs, and kids who are addicted to drugs. And those are pretty important distinctions, going back to this phenomenon of panicking unnecessarily. Lots and lots of kids smoke pot, lots and lots of kids drink, and although their parents may not be happy about it and it may not be the best thing they can do, they slide right through adolescence and never get into trouble, manage to get good grades, manage to live good lives, and go on to be adults. And that research has shown that the vast majority of kids who use drugs recreationally as teenagers stop on their own as they get into their 20s. And mm-hmm. that's what happened to me, and that's what happened to my kids. But the fact of the matter is that when it's going on in your family, you don't really feel that way. You feel like, you know, you just don't know what to do about it.
Well, it is tough. Like, this is the age of the public confessional, and you did, so can I. I mean, I did all sorts of underage drinking and probably smoked up half of Mexico, and that's
right.
Before it became before marijuana became an important domestic crop here in the United States, where now most of it is produced. I want to talk some in general about the problem. The book, by the way, I should introduce you from time to time because people join us. Meredith Moran is my guest, and her book from Harper San Francisco is called Dirty, A Search for Answers Inside America's Teenage Drug Epidemic. And so tell us your experience with your son, Jesse, and maybe at the same time use that as a vehicle to explain what you see as the larger problem.
Well, what happened with Jesse, as I said, is that he started getting into trouble when he was about 13, and he continued to get arrested, thrown out of schools, flunking school, passing out drunk on the lawn, et cetera, until he was 20. And during those years, I tried everything that I've since learned from writing dirty that most parents try when they have the resources to, which is, you know, you go to therapy and you go to family counseling and you send the kid here and you send the kid there and you sign him up for this and sign him up for that. And, you know, in my case, I'm a freelance writer, so I was able to actually basically stop working except as I could around his crises so that I was always available when he got into trouble at school, and that was a luxury most parents don't have. We did everything we could, and basically nothing worked until he finally got arrested and sent to jail as an adult when he was 19. He got arrested for the last time and spent a little time inside a real jail, and that was enough to turn him around. But when he was doing better, I started really wondering why it was that so many kids are in so much trouble in this country today, and whether it's drugs or not, just, you know, kids not feeling good. And, you know, as I was saying before, the difference between using drugs and abusing drugs, you know, kids use drugs because it's fun and because they're bored and because, you know, the same reasons that adults have a martini at night. But when it gets into abuse or addiction, that's when you have to really look and say, you know, why is this kid getting into so much trouble? And there are just so many of them, and that's why I decided to spend a couple of years following three kids who were in three different rehab programs, and that's what I did. And I tried to find kids who were really different from Jesse and really different from each other so that I could get a pretty sweeping view of what all the various reasons are that make kids get into trouble with drugs.
Was your son Jesse enrolled in the DARE program at any time?
Oh, yeah, and in elementary school, my kids got the whole lecture, and it rolled right off their backs just like it rolls off everybody else's. And, you know, we've since learned through research that the DARE program is not only a failure but also actually seems to have increased the drug use of the kids who...
I don't know why I'm laughing.
I know, it's really not funny. It's you laugh to keep from crying, basically.
Well, I laugh, too, because in a sense, there's almost this arrogance of the program, you know, people in charge of it, like they're doing God's work or something. And it seems to me, from everything I've seen, to be the opposite, even to the extent since the counselors or the teachers, however, whatever they're called, they always want to, they don't want to sound square. So they don't want to talk about yesterday's drugs. So
right.
They're introducing these drugs to kids. Say, well, you got to watch out for the,
right.
And it's like the newest drug. And a third of the class has never even heard of it before. And they go, oh,
until
ice.
Until they get to school that day.
I never heard that. I wonder how that feels.
And, you know, going back to your earlier question, why does this happen? Why do kids do this? And when you were saying, you know, sometimes people say, well, you can't just blame society. You have to look at the family role. And I completely agree with that. And believe me, our family got raked over the therapeutic coals plenty of times in the 7 years that Jesse was in and out of juvenile hall and jail. And that's not to say that families don't have big responsibility, but when I talk about the social causes, I'm a mom, but I'm a mom in the United States of America in this era, and I watched what happened for me when I had to decide whether I was going to pick my kids up from school at 5, you know, from the child care at 5, and risk my job because my boss was watching me leave work at 4:30, or, you know, was I going to stay until 5 or 6 like everyone else and have my kids be the last kids picked up? And, you know, my situation is replicated in so many families. There's just economic hardships that make people work more hours than we want to, and also just kind of the unraveling of communities. We don't live near our relatives anymore. The people who used to be support for families, for parents, aren't there anymore, and the isolation of people in neighborhoods, all those things just make it a lot harder to raise kids today than the way it was and the way we'd all like to do it.
Yeah, I think that's very well said and very important to say, because I don't put any stock whatsoever in the conservative argument, because once a problem has taken on a mass expression in the millions, in the millions and millions, you're talking about social phenomena, and then different people react to it differently. Obviously, very poor kids and poverty kids are going to react much more negatively, act out the worst scripts that, given their position in society, than, say, middle-class or upper-class kids. But as we know, and your own experience, middle-class kids also express angst and fear and anxiety about life through drugs, unfortunately.
As I say in the book, drug abuse is the most democratic phenomenon I've ever seen. More so, you know, people say that about HIV as an example, that a virus doesn't discriminate. But even more so, you know, I've seen in some of the communities where I've gone and spoken to parents, I've seen, you know, the richest kids are the heaviest into drugs like heroin, and the poor kids in the ghetto a lot of times have actually seen the effects of crack on their neighborhoods and on their families, so if anything, they are more sort of averse to trying it. So you really can't say I'm safe because my family is this or my family is that. And I think the important thing to look at is, you know, how can we change our priorities so that kids feel important, so parents have the time that we all want to have to spend with our kids, that our neighborhoods have the kind of community resources that kids need, you know, after-school programs, music and arts in the school, all the things that make kids feel good about themselves, give them something to do, make them happy, and give them ways to have fun that don't involve getting high.
Meredith Barron is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. The book is Dirty, and that's its title. We're talking about answers to America's teenage drug problem. And you followed these three people. Now, the conventional wisdom is that middle-class kids get therapy and poor kids get jail. It sounded like your son Jesse got both. But is there a class and race component to all this?
Definitely. And again, one of the reasons I followed three different kids through 2 years of their lives was I wanted to see how that played out. So I followed one boy who's from a white, poor family named Mike, and one boy who's white and from a wealthy family, and his name is Tristan, and an African-American girl who happened to be from an upper-middle-class family named Zalika. And by following these kids and seeing the programs the drug programs they went into and what their lives were like, I saw how Tristan, for example, who was a wealthy young man, had never been handcuffed, let alone arrested, even though he had committed crimes far more serious than the ones that Mike had committed. But Mike, being from a poor area, even though he was also white, had been in and out of juvenile hall most of his teenage years. And Zalika, on the other hand, who is black, but from a wealthy family, had sort of opted into ghetto street life and had been treated like a ghetto kid, even though she wasn't from that neighborhood, and consequently also had spent most of her life in juvenile hall.
Yeah, one of the horrible periods in Europe was the 30 Years' War, and that's what we have here with the so-called war on drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And it was to be judged in same terms we judged that period back in European history. Equally, we'd have to look upon it and look at the resources wasted, the people whose lives have been ruined by being sent to jail, yet there's great profit to be made in the war on drugs.
Follow the money.
Okay, I wanted to pick up that thread again.
Yeah.
So who's making out on this?
Well, you know, 60% of the people in American prisons today are there for nonviolent drug offenses. And not to say that you wouldn't want, you know, you don't want the person who broke into your car so he could get a fix out on the streets. But until you change, address his addiction, you're not going to get him off the streets. You're not going to get the problem solved. And America has now become the number one jailer in the world. There's no country in the world that jails a higher percentage of its population than America does. So, again, when you say, well, you can blame the families, you can blame this, you can blame that, but when you've got a phenomenon as widespread as this, you've really got to start looking at the social causes. And as far as who makes money, well, prisons, as we know, have become a private industry now. They're extremely profitable, and I get reminded of that every day because Mike is in jail right now, and I get, you know, these collect calls from him a couple times a day that cost about $8 for the first, you know, 3 minutes. And, you know, if you really want to wonder why so many people are in jail, start looking at who's making money off of imprisoning people.
Yeah, I know, for instance, in California, where you live, in fact, you could probably speak to this better than I could, that the Prison Guards Union is one of the most powerful political entities in the state. I think it either is number one or number two in how much it contributes to political causes, all of which keeping stiff sentences, keeping people in prison as long
right.
as possible. So here you have these people whose occupation is dependent upon us continuing to lock up people, as a guy here in Detroit once said, John Sinclair, for smoking flowers.
Right. And I remember John Sinclair very well. And
okay.
Yes, and also beyond just the employment of prison guards, there's the construction industry that profits off of building new prisons. And here in California, we've built many more prisons in the last 20 years than we have schools. And I think that's a very telling fact. And I think they're very much related. I think if we reversed the order and spent more money on schools and less money on prisons, we would need prisons less, and unfortunately public schools don't make money for anybody, and that's why we're not doing it.
Now, this is addiction to me is a mental health or a physical health problem and should be dealt with in that regard. But you also have an enormous treatment industry. Well, how do you assess that? Is it all bad, all good, or some good, some bad?
I think it's some good and some bad. And once again, I think, you know, the more profit-driven aspects of it are the less reputable ones. Unfortunately, most kids who are poor or even middle class don't have access to the best treatment. When I was in Minneapolis recently, I visited the Hazelden facility for teenagers, and which is extremely expensive, and it's very wonderful setup they have there and beautiful facilities and all that. And then, you know, I thought about the kind of treatment that the kids I wrote about in Dirty were getting, where they're, you know, locked up in grimy juvenile halls or being, quote-unquote, treated in, you know, in a courtroom with people who are paid less than department store clerks to look after them. So, you know, once again, it does have to do with how much you can afford to buy. I think the biggest problem with the teenage drug treatment in this country is that it's modeled on adult drug treatment, and anybody who's ever dealt with teenagers knows they're not just young adults. They are also, you know, older children, and their issues and the way to reach them is very different from the way you would talk to a 50-year-old.
Meredith Merritt, I'm going to go way out on a limb. You can tell me how far out on the branch you're going to join me. I'm totally libertarian about this, and I would call for the legalization of all drugs, even the ones that we know are very destructive to the human body when used in an abusive manner. So that and then deal with the problems that result, just as we do from alcoholism, in a manner appropriate to what people are experiencing. Not treat our neighbors, our friends, or families as criminals for wanting to alter their consciousness. Do you have any remarks regarding legalization?
Well, I actually agree with you, but I don't really focus on that when I talk about Dirty, because one of the things I found is that there's a lot of talk about adults and adult issues where drugs are concerned, and not very much that have to do with teenagers. So, yes, I'm in favor of it, because I see a lot of kids getting criminal records because they have a problem with drugs, and I don't want to see that happen. At the same time, I don't really emphasize that, because I think the important thing is really to, again, to look at the causes. Why are kids feeling so much despair? Why are they not being paid attention to the way they should at school and at home? What can we do to change the way their lives are so that, you know, they can smoke a little pot or drink a little, but they don't lose their lives to the criminal justice system or to drug overdoses?
Well, the other thing is, too, I'm thinking about my statement and how absolutist it was. We don't want, it's all right for me to go home and drink a glass or two of wine. We don't want our 11-year-old doing that.
And it's a very individual problem and a very individual solution. You know, we can't really make rules, and I found that out in my own family with two boys a year apart with the same parents and the same lives, and yet, you know, my older son smoked pot all through high school and did fine and, you know, ended up graduating from UC Berkeley, and my younger son, you know, started smoking pot and immediately started getting into trouble with it. So, you know, you really can't make a general rule, and this, again, points to the fact that kids need a lot more attention, a lot more one-on-one than they're getting both at school and in their families.
Now, I'm looking at our clock. We have about 3.5 minutes left, and I want to split that, or maybe we'll have time for something else, on two questions. The final one, we never finally talked about what your son Jesse is now doing, which I think is an extraordinary story.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, it's the idea of a society that, and you mentioned in your book about how many antidepressants people are taking, but it's when you turn on television, it's drugs for solutions to everything, including everything from hay fever to whatever else they've got.
Excellent point. It's so important that you bring that up. And it's really funny, because not only do we swallow pills for everything that's wrong with us or imagine to be wrong with us as adults, but also I've noticed in talking with folks about Dirty and about the adolescent drug problem, parents want pills too. You know, we want a sort of psychological pill or behavioral pill. You know, I do these talks and I say what I'm saying to you, and parents sit there and say, yeah, but what should I do? How can I keep my kid from using drugs? And I think, you know, we want that kind of instant karma, that instant easy solution to a problem, and it's just not that simple.
Yeah, it's not. I don't know how you turn that around? I mean, in many ways, and what I'm going to say does little for the individual problems. I mean, we need really a whole renewal of life in this society. It doesn't appear to be on the agenda. In fact, we're so high in fear and anxiety about the future, understandably, I am, that no one right now is putting forth that vision of how we could reduce that fear, to have a society that works, where we don't have the highest imprisonment rate in the world and the rest of it.
I couldn't agree with you more, and in fact, we could do a whole show on the relationship between the war in Iraq and the war on drugs, and you know, it would be a pretty shocking conversation. But I think there's a definite relationship between the fear level that exists and that is being, in my opinion, really pumped up, the kind of presence that the United States has in the world and the kind of values that we exemplify in the world really are reflected in the kind of values that we have here at home. And I think the same thing that makes so many of our politicians and corporate heads, liars and thieves and crooks, really, you know, don't think that our kids don't notice what kind of leadership we have and what kind of values we're espousing in the world. And then, you know, that makes a definite impact on how they feel they should be living their lives here at home.
Meredith Marin, less than 60 seconds, your son Jesse, what became of him?
Well, Jesse is now a minister. He's a Christian minister, and he is a leader in his church, and he's also doing prison ministry through his church. He goes and ministers to prisoners in the very same places where he was once in prison. So talk about turning it around. He really did that, and I'm so proud of him.
And if I give a little more to it, he came from an ethnic Jewish family and an African-American Christian church.
That's right.
I love it.
The church that he attributes was saving his life. He was brought to the church by his basketball coach in hopes of saving him, and that's exactly what happened, and that's the church he belongs to.
That's amazing. James Fry, author of A Million Little Pieces, says, Dirty is an accurate and realistic portrayal of teenage drug use, what kids do, how they do it, why they do it. Parents should read this book. Kids should read this book. Meredith Marin has been my guest on the Peter Werby Show. The book is Dirty, A Search for Answers Inside America's Teenage Drug Epidemic. It's published by Harper San Francisco. Meredith Marin, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the RIF Cyber Crew. Get your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the RIF on-air giveaways.
Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air.
Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, that sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the RIF Cyber Crew today.
Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream. It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too.
WRIF.com.
More Riff Rock is coming right up.
Living with depression can change your quality of life. Depression leaves you feeling sad, irritable, and tired. You lose interest and quit doing the things you used to enjoy, like going to the movies or out for dinner. You feel a loss of connection from your friends and family. You can't seem to motivate yourself to get out and do anything. You may have trouble sleeping. People who are depressed say it's like living life in black and white. If this sounds like you, you are not alone. Over 50 million Americans will suffer from depression sometime during their lifetime. Depression is not a personality problem or weakness. It is a real condition that affects the brain. Dr. Robert Bielski and the Institute for Health Studies are offering an investigational medication research study for depression. If you qualify, you'll receive study medication and all research-related care at no cost to you. For more information, call the Institute for Health Studies toll-free at 1-877-908-CARE. That's 1-877-908-CARE.
Imagine not being afraid to go to the dentist. Imagine being able to accomplish all of your dental care in as little as one appointment. This is what Sedation Dentistry at Dr. Katz in Livonia can do for you. You'll be able to smile with confidence and be proud of your appearance. If you've been putting off years of dental work, Sedation Dentistry will change your life. Over 35 million Americans have some level of anxiety when it comes to going to the dentist. But for many, it's more than being afraid. At Dr. Katz in Livonia, they understand that your fears may have kept you from the dentist. There's no need to feel embarrassed. At Dr. Katz in Livonia, they're not here to judge you. They're here to help you and encourage you so that you have the confidence a beautiful smile can bring. The experienced clinical team members at Dr. Katz in Livonia will make certain that you're relaxed and completely comfortable as they monitor you very closely while you're sedated. Many patients feel no discomfort whatsoever during and after the treatment. It may be as simple as taking a pill. Let Dr. Katz help you begin to enjoy your visits to the dentist with Sedation Dentistry. Wake up to a beautiful smile at Dr. Katz in Livonia. Call today for your free consultation. 734-464-2000. That's 734-464-2000.
Broadcasting worldwide on the web, you're listening to 101 WRIF at WRIF.com, a service of Greater Media. Keep it here for more Riff Rock coming right up.
All day Thursday, your walk right in free station, 101 The Riff, unleashes a ticket blitz Thursday. Keep your radio locked on 101 WRIF all day this Thursday
for your chance to hook up with tickets to all of the hottest concerts and events happening around the Motor City.
Hooking you up like no other Detroit station can.
Listen for your chance to win.
Then call a Riff request line at 313-298-WRIF.
Don't forget.
You can always improve your chances to win by joining the Riff Cyber Crew today and score your totally unfair internet advantage.
Just log on to WRIF.com.
It's Ticket Blitz Thursday on the Riff all day Thursday
from your walk right in free station. 101 The Riff.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Pelosino's Pizza and Grinders with 18 locations, one near you. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine Online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com.
Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's five best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Hello.
How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked to Bo Jackson. We had to ask him how much that bad hip has slowed him down.
I can guarantee you right now that I can come to your office and outrun both of
I can beat you in a 40 right now. What's your 40 time?
I couldn't beat you without a wet paper sack, man.
I don't know, Bo. I think you're still gimpy.
Gimpy, even when I was playing, but I was faster than 60-70% of the guys on the baseball field.
Podcast on the Peter Werby Show by telling you a little anecdote or a little something. And I'm going to do that, but I want to bring our guest in on it. So let me bring her right up to our microphones. Our guest this morning is Zoe Weil, and she has written Above All, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times. And it's published by New Society Publishers, one of my favorite publishers. You can go to newsociety.com. So, Weil, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
It's great to be here, Peter. Thank you.
And so this is about how to raise kids, and it's pretty tough. My wife and I never had children, and I was talking to a friend of mine the other day. In fact, it was yesterday with a five-year-old, and we were talking about the world and what a fearful place it's becoming with terrorism, with pandemics, an unsteady economy. And he said, I'm so afraid for my kid in the future. And I guess that's in a way what you mean by challenging times.
That's right.
Yeah. And I don't know. I guess they seem so challenging to me that not having a kid is okay. But you have children, I assume.
I have one son. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's 10 years old.
And I actually did not introduce you fully, though. You're the co-founder and president of the International Institute for Humane Education. Give us an example of what that's all about.
Well, what we do at the International Institute for Humane Education is we train people to be humane educators. That is, to teach young people how they can live with respect and compassion and kindness toward everybody, including other people, other species, and the earth itself. So that's what humane education is all about. And, in fact, it was my work as a humane educator that led me to write this book. I had been going into schools and teaching young people about humane values and how they can live according to their deepest values. And while I was doing that, I had a son, and I was trying to raise him according to these same values. And it occurred to me that I was reaching out to teachers to train them to be humane educators, and I was reaching out to students in my own work, but I'd never tried to reach out to parents. And so that's why I wrote the book, Above All Be Kind, to actually give parents the tools that I had learned as a humane educator.
I'm sure you know the stereotype of the child educator or the child psychologist that just has a monster for a kid. So I know this isn't a fair question, but how are your ideas about education working with your child? How old did you say how old he was?
He's 10 years old.
Okay, you didn't, yeah.
And, well, so far so good, but I would hate for him to be judged based on what I've learned as a humane educator, or for me to be judged as a humane educator based on how well I parent, because there is no question that parenting is by far the hardest job that anybody can ever take on.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I fail every day as a parent, and every day I keep trying, and every day I do a little bit better. But what I hope is that my book will give parents some tools that they didn't have already. And specifically, what I learned as a humane educator is that there are four elements that are involved in raising or teaching a child how they can be humane. And so I gave those to parents so that they can raise their own children to be humane. And those elements are, the first one is providing information. Pretty basic thing, but without good, accurate information about the effects of our choices, it's hard to be humane. It's hard to put our deepest values into practice if we don't know the effects of our choices and our lifestyles. And humane education is more than just being kind in our interactions with our family and friends. It's really about being kind to everybody, so that it means being kind to the person who makes your clothes halfway around the world, or the animals who are involved in the foods you eat, or the clothes you wear, or the products you use. It's a really global and very far-reaching idea. So the first element is providing information. The second element is teaching your children how to be critical thinkers. Because without the ability to think critically, children and all of us really are just at the mercy of whatever media tell us, whatever advertising tells us and commercials tell us.
Sure.
And it becomes very difficult to really know what we believe if we're not able to be critical thinkers and evaluate information.
Let's back up, Joe, because I know that there are four of them, and I think each one of them deserves a little attention. You were, you explained number one, critical thinking. I mean, there's a lot of competition, as you said. I mean, the most alluring competition, of course, is television, and I suppose some extent like video games and the internet.
Yep.
How does the parent pose themselves as a more credible teacher of critical thinking than all the bombardment that our children get from images that often are very disturbing or very self-serving for the image generator?
Right. Good question. One of the things I did in my book is I divided it into periods of age and development. So there's a chapter on the early years, then the middle years, and then adolescence. So it really depends on how old your child is. If your child is very young, you know, birth to, let's say, six, the best thing that I would say in terms of helping your child to be critically aware of things, because you're not going to turn a toddler or infant into a critical thinker, is to keep the media out of your child's life as much as possible. Turn off the TV. You know, you might want to use videos that you think are really valuable to your child, but for the most part, turn the TV off, because all of those commercial messages that they're going to get, even if the program is benign and nice, all of the commercial messages are going to make your child, even from a very, very young age, want things and think they're not okay if they don't have things,
mm-hmm.
and they're too young for critical thinking at that point. But by the time they get to be adolescents, the best thing you can do is sit down and analyze the media with your child. Sit while they're watching television, and when the commercials come on, talk about them. You know, ask them, hey, that beer commercial, why do you think it was a short story about falling in love? Or if you're looking through a magazine with your teenage daughter, you can ask her, that's so interesting, isn't it, that they're showing these girls in these poses with boys where the boys seem to adore them because of how they look and not about who they are. And ask them questions. Get them to think critically about how they're being sold love and they're being sold happiness and joy, which is what advertisers will use. They will prey on our deepest desires and needs in order to sell us products. But the products, of course, can never give us those deepest satisfactions in life. So by analyzing this with our child, we help them to become critical thinkers. It's not that we don't let them be exposed to this information. They will be as they get older. But as much as we can limit it as they're young and be with them as they're older, the more we can influence them to be critical thinkers. It's not that we're asking them to believe everything we say. I want my son to be critical of me as well. I want him to be able to determine whether what he's told from any source is true.
Sure. What a wonderful idea. So Weil is my guest. She is the author of Above All, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times. And this is obviously a question that's a setup, particularly given what you just said. But what's your thought of television as babysitter? I've seen people put infants in front of television and say, well, that'll keep them quiet for a while. I mean, I'm talking like a four-month-old.
Well, I was guilty of it, not quite that young, but I was guilty of it when my son was two, and I just wanted some time, and I plopped him in front of the TV or in front of a video, and one video that had come out right when he was young was Lion King, and I sat him down in front of it, and it was only years later when his preschool teacher actually showed a group of us parents The Lion King and The Wizard of Oz and Star Wars, showed us these videos and just took out clips from them. So there was a scene from The Lion King that was particularly brutal, and she said, you know, these are nice movies, but they're not for our very young children.
Hmm.
And I was stunned because I hadn't thought of it myself, and she was absolutely right. These images aren't appropriate for very young children. They can't. How can a very young child process fratricide and being blamed for the death of his father, as the protagonist in The Lion King is? I mean, these are really strong and powerful messages. Do we really want our two-year-old to have them?
I know this four-year-old. In fact, it was the son of the man I was describing earlier, when he'll be watching videos and he says, I think I need somebody in here with me.
Well,
go ahead.
Well, all I mean to say is that all of us parents, we do the best we can, and I do not, you know, blame any parent for needing some time and plopping their kid in front of the TV because they need some time and that's a great babysitter. But because I'm guilty of it too. But the more we can become aware, the more we can do the best for our kids. That's what I hope my book will offer people, suggestions of other ways of being with their child and raising their child that would be better. And these mm-hmm. are things I've learned along the way, and many people have taught me. And there's no one right way to do it, but these are ideas that hopefully will help parents in that process, because it's very challenging.
Well, let me ask you something, Zoe. You twice said that something you were guilty of it, and I forgot there was another phrase you used earlier that made me worry about sometimes parents who set the bar too high for themselves.
Yeah, that's a good point. What? And I can certainly castigate myself ad nauseum for all of the failures and mistakes I've made. And I don't think that, you know, certainly my parents' generation, they did not do that. They didn't worry about every last thing. So there's something to be said for a little bit of benign neglect around some of these things, because we can overdo it. But it's becoming more aware. The third chapter of my book, it's called Your Life is Your Message, and it's really about how what we say as parents doesn't mean nearly as much as what we do. So, you know, if we've moved the TV out of the living room someplace, you know, in the house where you have to make an effort to go watch it, and if we go outside with our families and we go on walks and outings and whatever, you know, we go to a nature center, if we do those sorts of things together, or if we tell stories before bed, you know, with our children, like actually make up stories for them. You know, I thought when somebody first planted that seed in my mind, I thought there's no way I'm going to be able to do that. But I tried it, and in fact, it was one of the most powerful and beautiful rituals that we ever got into in our family. And my husband and I would take turns every night making up a story for our son, and he loved it. So there's things that we can do, but it's just a matter of taking the step to learn more and not let all of the forces around us control who we're going to be and what we're going to do.
Well, actually, I suspect I may have even mentioned this on the show before. I'm always struck by this graffiti that I remember written on a sidewalk that said, define yourself or be defined. And certainly when you're a child, defining yourself is what's happening as you're maturing. But hopefully that's assisted by people that love and nurture you, as opposed to those forces outside that I was talking earlier about the generation of images. Those images are always generated, even if they're meant to make you laugh or whatever, for the benefit of the person actually generating them, not for the receptor, is actually completely taking them in passively.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's go through some more of the four key elements to raising humane children. We talked about providing information and also teaching critical thinking. Then is instilling the three R's, but they're different ones than we remember.
Right. They're reverence, respect, and responsibility. And I talk about those in the book in terms of age and development, so that the first of those R's, reverence, is what we can nurture in our very young children. You know, we're not going to be teaching them to be respectful and responsible when they're just 3 years old. But that's the time to really awaken their reverence for what it is that's good to revere. You know, as we were just talking about with TV and media, you know, do we want our children revering the Mutant Ninja Turtles? Is that what we really want them to revere? Or do we want them to revere truly courageous and honest and kind characters? And we can read books about those characters who have these qualities. Or we can, again, take them outside, let them fall in love with this beautiful earth we live on so that they'll grow up to want to protect it. Because without reverence, it becomes much harder to promote respect and instill responsibility. And as they get a little bit older, we do want to help encourage them to have an attitude of respect toward everyone and everything. And that respect will inevitably lead toward responsibility, so that they will become, instead of just consumers, citizens. They will become conscious and deliberate because they will recognize that they have a responsibility to make their life choices reflect their respect and their reverence. Excuse me. And so that's what the three R's really means to me, is that we enable young people to grow from a young age of reverence to become young adults who are responsible.
I'm looking at the press release that your publisher, New Society Publishers, sent out for Above All, Be Kind. And it says, what leads a child to taunt a classmate, throw trash on the ground, or hurl rocks at squirrels? Don't you think most of us, and I know you didn't write this, but most of us would say, well, boys. I mean, this sounds almost like a 90% description of boy children.
Yes.
I mean, is there an essential, problem of essential nature? I mean, here they're going to have a boy that's taunting classmates, throwing trash on the ground, and hurling rocks at squirrels, where little girls are all those stereotypes not true anymore?
Well, I think they are still true, but, you know, you can have girls who are talking behind each other's backs and excluding some other girl from the group and doing all sorts of other things, which can be very hurtful. But, you know, I have a son who is very much a boy, who he, from the very youngest age, he was turning sticks into guns. And, you know, as you might expect, I didn't raise him to turn anything into guns. I didn't get him toy guns as a child, but he naturally did that. On the other hand, I also inspired his reverence for the natural world. And we have a pond behind our house. And every summer, we would lie on rafts, and we would float around the pond, and the pond is filled with frogs. And I taught him to just put his hand out in front of a frog, and if the frog wanted to, the frog would jump on his hand. And there were times when he would float around on the pond with three or four frogs on the raft and a couple in his hands or on his hands. And he didn't hurt them. He didn't grab them, because I was able to inspire him in him reverence for these other animals. So, yes, he's still a little boy. He still has all of those same impulses. But he learned from a young age to appreciate that the frog can feel, and that the frog wants to live a life without being scared, just like he does. So it is possible with any child to raise their appreciation appreciation and respect for other beings and for the natural world, so that he, and if he does litter, I'll tell him why we don't litter, how mm-hmm. it can harm. And so he learns that sort of thing.
What if he wanted, or did he want, like a toy gun?
Oh, he did want a toy gun, and this was a real struggle for us. And I write about this in the book, about what do you do if your five-year-old wants a toy gun. And basically I encourage parents to use these same elements, you know, to get information. What are the effects of toy guns on children? To think critically about it. To decide whether or not it's going to inspire reverence, respect, and responsibility or not. And some people will fall on different sides of this. You know, they might want their child to have a gun, but to teach them how to use it responsibly. You know, not to point it at other people, but, you know, to point it at a target or something like that. But what ended up happening with our son is he wanted it, and we kept saying, no, we don't get guns in our house, and this is why. But we were at a fair. He was 7 years old, and we were at a fair, and, you know, it was one of those where they had the booths where you could play games and then win prizes. And before we knew it, he'd won, and the guy behind the counter handed him a water pistol. And, you know, he looked at us and said, please, can I keep it? And there was no way that we were going to take that away from him at that point. He'd won it. He really wanted it. So we got a water pistol. So I had to modify my own beliefs and struggle with them in order to really respect where he was at. And we just had rules around it. You know, you don't point the water gun at animals. And if you're going to have, you know, play with your friends with it, you don't point it at their faces and, you know, those sorts of things. So it's a struggle.
Now, it sounded like you don't have a problem, though, with, say, a family that has those values of reverence, respect, and responsibility in terms of relationship to, say, nature and animals, actually training their children in the actual use of firearms. A lot of rural families and, you know, country families, that's a part of their culture. How does that fall in as a humane education, or does that not make it in your book?
Well, you know, one thing that I don't do in my book, and I don't do as a teacher, is tell people what their choices should be. I try to open people's hearts and minds and have them explore what their own deepest values are. And by the way, when you ask people what are the best qualities of human beings, which is one of the definitions of the word humane, they pretty much all say the same thing, and I write about that in the first chapter of my book. So people tend to agree on what these values are. What we often disagree about is how do we interpret these values. And it's not my job as a humane educator or even as a writer, in my mind, to tell people what their choices should be. My job is to inspire them to think very, very deeply and get good, solid information, think critically, and use as a guiding principle reverence, respect, and responsibility, and then make the best choice that they can make mm-hmm. for themselves and their children. And if people are doing that, my suspicion is we'll be pretty closely aligned. You know, we're not going to agree on everything, but we'd have a far better world, and we'd raise a generation that could be problem solvers and beautiful people who are actually citizens to try to make some of the problems in our world go away.
Zoe Weil is the author of Above All, Be Kind. We're talking about four key elements in raising humane children. We've already covered providing information, teaching critical thinking, instilling reverence, respect, and responsibility. And the fourth one, and boy, our time is going. I wanted to ask you one question after this, so let's make sure we save some time. Offering positive choices. How do you do that? I mean, usually adults tell children, here's what you're going to do.
And certainly for very young children, you know, we parents make the decisions for them when they're very young. But as they get older, we can help them to make choices, and we can encourage them to make choices that are positive. You know, the fourth element is what makes the others meaningful. If you were to, for example, tell your child about, you know, the horrors of child slaves working in West Africa, picking the cocoa beans that wind up in chocolate bars, and you didn't give them a choice of getting a fair trade organic chocolate bar, then you might be instilling real cynicism and apathy rather than instilling citizenship and positive, responsible choice-making. So as parents, first we need to go on the journey ourselves. We need to be making ourselves aware of the choices that are out there that can improve the world and that can improve the plight of other species and the earth and other people. And then we offer these to our children. Now, you know, in our family, we're vegetarians, and we raised our son to be vegetarian. But he came to be 7, 8 years old, and we left that decision up to him. And he has chosen to remain vegetarian, but, you know, that decision is up to him. He now has the information, he has the tools that he can make that decision for himself.
Now, I was just going to say, because I want to make sure we get this in, and my people should pick up the book. That's where you get the full information here. We're just whetting your appetite for Zoe Weil's book, Above All, Be Kind. We have these elements, and then, of course, the real test is in at critical junctures in the history of a family or in a country. And your subtitle, which I haven't mentioned in a while, is Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times. Now, Zoe, your son was about 7 years old when September 11th occurred, and how do you deal with that? I mean, how does a child, I mean, think about the horrific things that are happening in Iraq and Afghanistan, Palestine, things like that. But just here in America, did that raising a humane child with your son, how did September 11th, how did that all connect?
Well, he was pretty young, and so we tried to keep him protected from all of the media around it because we felt he was too young to take in the horror of that. I mean, he actually heard about it when we did on the radio in the car, but then we turned the radio down really, really, really low and put it only in the front part of the car so he wouldn't hear anymore because it was just too much too soon. And so I do recommend to parents to, as far as possible, err on the side of protecting your child as long as possible. But then as your children get older, the questions to raise are, how can we solve this problem? You know, a year ago, we were faced with two opposite choices. We either, you know, basically do nothing except continue the status quo, or we invade Iraq. And what struck me so strongly then and still to this day does is the black and white thinking in that, as if there are only two choices, as if we had exhausted all other possibilities for trying to solve some of these terrible problems that we face. And I think that, you know, as human beings, we are inclined to think in black and white terms, and the media and government will often exacerbate that. I mean, even the fact that we have a two-party system, as if there's only two ways to look at things.
Mm-hmm.
So what I do as a humane educator, and we actually have an activity designed to get, we call it many colors as opposed to black and white thinking, is to get students to think about these issues. What else can we do? What are other ways to solve our problems? Whether the issue is the northern spotted owl versus loggers in the Pacific Northwest, or whether to invade Iraq or not, what are the other choices we have? And if we can raise our children to think in those many color ways, to think not in black and white terms, but as problem solvers, I think we will go very far towards solving the actual problems we face on this planet.
I think so. So, Weil, thanks for being with us. Again, the book is Above All, Be Kind, Raising a Humane Child in Challenging Times. New Society Publishers is who put it out. It's available in bookstores or through newsociety.com. So, Weil, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the Riff Cyber Crew. Get your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the Riff on-air giveaways.
Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air.
Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, that sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the Riff Cyber Crew today.
Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream. It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too.
WRIF.com.
More Riff Rock is coming right up.
Imagine not being afraid to go to the dentist. Imagine being able to accomplish all of your dental care in as little as one appointment. This is what Sedation Dentistry at Dr. Katz in Livonia can do for you. You'll be able to smile with confidence and be proud of your appearance. If you've been putting off years of dental work, Sedation Dentistry will change your life. Over 35 million Americans have some level of anxiety when it comes to going to the dentist. But for many, it's more than being afraid. At Dr. Katz in Livonia, they understand that your fears may have kept you from the dentist. There's no need to feel embarrassed. At Dr. Katz in Livonia, they're not here to judge you. They're here to help you and encourage you so that you have the confidence a beautiful smile can bring. The experienced clinical team members at Dr. Katz in Livonia will make certain that you're relaxed and completely comfortable as they monitor you very closely while you're sedated. Many patients feel no discomfort whatsoever during and after the treatment. It may be as simple as taking a pill. Let Dr. Katz help you begin to enjoy your visits to the dentist with Sedation Dentistry. Wake up to a beautiful smile at Dr. Katz in Livonia. Call today for your free consultation. 734-464-2000. That's 734-464-2000.
Living with depression can change your quality of life. Depression leaves you feeling sad, irritable, and tired. You lose interest and quit doing the things you used to enjoy, like going to the movies or out for dinner. You feel a loss of connection from your friends and family. You can't seem to motivate yourself to get out and do anything. You may have trouble sleeping. People who are depressed say it's like living life in black and white. If this sounds like you, you are not alone. Over 50 million Americans will suffer from depression sometime during their lifetime. Depression is not a personality problem or weakness. It is a real condition that affects the brain. Dr. Robert Bielski and the Institute for Health Studies are offering an investigational medication research study for depression. If you qualify, you'll receive study medication and all research-related care at no cost to you. For more information, call the Institute for Health Studies toll-free at 1-877-908-CARE. That's 1-877-908-CARE.
We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment. This is 101 WRIF, broadcasting worldwide at WRIF.com. Thanks for listening.
The American people have a right to know.
The Riff's Midnight Metal. Tuesday through Thursday nights on The Riff. Join Screamin' Scott Randall for the loudest hour on your radio.
That's what this is all about.
Midnight Metal. Midnight Metal on The Riff. Call in your heavier-than-hell requests at 313-298-WRIF. You can also fax in or email for requests and your chance to win killer Riff swag.
Send your faxes to 248-398-6219 or email screamin' at WRIF.com.
Get your fix of the heaviest 60 minutes in the Motor City. It's Midnight Metal.
Is America a better place to live because of our efforts?
Tuesday through Thursday nights with Screaming Sky.
From your home for Midnight Metal, the home of rock and roll. 101. The Riff.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Kickers All-American Grill on Plymouth Road in Livonia. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's five best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We talked to our old pal William Sanders about his son Barry going into the Hall of Fame.
They asked Barry who's going to give the induction speech, and he says, my dad. And he said, who's going to tell him he can't?
I got it fixed already.
You've already made the speech or already come up with it?
I already come up with it, yeah.
Really?
Now, somewhere in there, do you compare him to Jim Brown?
That's no secret what I'm going to say. I'm gonna say he's the third greatest running back I ever seen in my life.
Now who's first and second?
Me and Jim Brown.
He's not as good as Jim Brown.
Stop it,
Drew. That sounds good.
And Mike.
I hear you.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101
WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
Rocks.
Down.